20 minutes of 11, so we're appropriately late in beginning. We want to have a very, we look forward to a very positive, constructive morning with our friends from Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation. We're fortunate to have many House members join us for this joint committee hearing of the Transportation Committee, chaired by Representative Wilson, and the Judiciary Committee. And in attendance are Representative Johansson. Thank you. Representative Johansson, Representative Munoz, Representative Grunberg, Representative Duenberg, Dugan, Representative Holmes. In attendance are Representative Millett, who's been very constructive to this process, and we thank you for being the catalyst for today's meeting. Friend Representative Crawford is here. Representative Olson is with us. And I would encourage you in a few minutes to join us at the table if some of the other folks aren't here. You're certainly more than welcome to join us at any time that you feel is appropriate, beginning now. So to that end, we have two PowerPoints today. We would like to incorporate some public testimony at the end, or leave the possibility of public testimony open, and don't anticipate a lot today. We want to hear from DOT first to frame the issue, and then from the Department of Public Safety, and see what kind of solutions we can stitch together with these fine state agencies. Do any of the members wish to make an opening comment? I don't see Representative Hawkers here. I know that it's one of the hot spots across the state is in his district. Is any of the members that want to make some remarks? Representative Wilson, you're the chair of transportation. Oh, and my Representative Dahlstrom. Gosh, my right hand man. Representative Wilson, do you want to make some opening remarks? I'd also like to note that Representative Guttenberg has joined us online. Good morning, David. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think that as we get into the meeting today, we will learn more of the facts, and what we learn will make a difference of what we do. So I'm anxious to get started, and I did talk to Representative Hawker, and he actually has actually been down to Juneau and has talked with some of the DOT people, so he's been involved with this also. So I think if we just get started, we'll see what our actual facts are and go from there.
Any of the other members care to make opening comments? All right, so with that, I think we'll begin our PowerPoint with DOT. Gordon and Ron, are you going to make a PowerPoint? Who's going to present today?
I'm going to make some introductory comments, and then Ron Martin will do a PowerPoint.
Okay, Gordon, if you'll introduce yourself for the purpose of the record, and we're very happy to have you here.
Chair Ramirez, Chair Wilson, and committee members, thank you for letting us participate in your hearing today. For the record, I'm Gordon Keith. I'm the Central Region Director of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Despite the best efforts of the Department of Transportation, the Department of Public Safety, and the Alaska Highway Safety Office, people still have serious injury and fatality accidents on Alaska highways. The number of fatalities are trending downward, while the number of vehicle miles traveled, that's the number of miles people are traveling, is trending upward. The number of fatalities to date for this year are at the pace to be the lowest in recent years. There have been 40 deaths to date in 2009. If we extrapolate from that, there would be probably 60 deaths on our highways. In 2008, we had 63 deaths. And to give you a frame of reference, in 2003, we had 98 deaths. In 2004, we had 101 deaths. Even with the 60 deaths, that's still too many people that are dying on our highways. That's good Alaskans that are dying on our highways. This year, when I looked at the statistics of the deaths that I just described, one death was on the Dillingham-Electinget Road, one on McLean Road in Nome, and one on the Heidelberg Highway in Ketchikan. But 67% of the people of Alaska live in the central region, mainly in Anchorage, Mat-Su, and Kenai, and they are a large percentage of the deaths that we're seeing happening on our highways. And that is why we're here today, to talk about the traffic safety corridors. By definition, traffic safety zones are rural, two-lane highways with an average daily traffic of at least 2,000, and they have a serious injury or fatality rate higher than a set national or state standard. The four traffic safety corridors in Alaska all have one characteristic in common, and that is congestion. They have a volume of traffic that is greater than the capacity of the road. A rule of thumb is a two-lane highway carries about 12,000 cars a day. The Parks Highway from Wasilla to Big Lake routinely carries 19,000 to 20,000 cars a day, and the Seward Highway seasonally in the summertime carries about that much. So those highways are over capacity of about 67%. At that volume, some people drive aggressively, they tailgate, they take chances on passing and entering the lanes of traffic, and with that many cars on the road is what I call unforgiving. If you reach over to change the station on your TV, talk on a cell phone, nod off, not even fall asleep, but just nod off a little bit, any kind of distraction, and you find yourself in an accident. Volume road might be more forgiving. If one of those things happened, you might not find yourself hitting another car. For these reasons, the rate of accidents and the congestion, Central Region has designated four traffic safety zones. And first I want to thank the legislature in 2006 passing Senate Bill 261, which allowed for the traffic safety corridors. And we worked with the legislature. We patterned our traffic safety corridors after the state of Oregon and New Mexico that had quite a bit of success with them. Our four traffic safety corridors are the Seward Highway, Potter to Girdwood, Parks Highway, Big Lake to Wasilla, Kinnick Goose Bay Road, and the Sterling Highway from Sterling to Soldotna. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Ron Martindale of our traffic safety section to put on a PowerPoint, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now, or probably better wait till after Ron's given his PowerPoint.
Thank you, Gordon. I think we will wait until after the PowerPoint. We've been joined by Representative Lynn. We're grateful to see you. And another catalyst for today's meeting, Representative Hawker. And so his district is one of those four hotspots that are hit majorly. Ron, I'm going to ask you, I've previewed this PowerPoint, and it's extensive and an enormous amount of material, very useful and constructive, but we want to move through it with some haste so that we can then reference the germane pieces, particularly our interest, I believe, in talking with Representative Wilson, is to try and lay out the plan that DOT can present, the plan that public safety can present, and then to perhaps innovate a little bit of a roundtable to talk about how we can overlap those two agencies to better protect the public. Because, Gordon, one of the things that you did touch on is, although improvements for DOT have led to less traffic fatalities, I think we are all keenly aware that the public's tolerance for traffic fatalities is declining at a greater rate than the manner in which we're creating safety. We don't need to look any further than DUI laws over the last 10 or 15 or 20 years to see that the public's tolerance for being able to enjoy, you know, have their quiet enjoyment of their lives and safe transport from point A to point B has become an ever larger and looming issue for the public. And it is one of our core charges from the Constitution, is not only transportation, but also public safety. And so I'm delighted that we're here. We do look forward to your PowerPoint and proceed. Thank you very much. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Ron Martindale. I'm the Central Region Highway Safety Improvement Program Coordinator. So I don't necessarily speak for the whole state, but I do track statistics for the whole state. Mainly, though, are my duties in the Central Region. And, yes, I promise I will. These go pretty fast. I'm trying to set some background, but I'll, if it looks like I'm slowing somebody down, throw something at me or give me a signal, and I'll give you
a speed hump.
Again, my name is Ron Martindale from DOT. I want to give you a little bit of background on crashes. Like Gordon said earlier, statewide, numbers of fatal crashes have gone down. We've seen a fair amount of success. It's never good enough, but with the green line on the chart you're seeing is the traffic volumes increasing. And the other lines, the blue is the number of fatal crashes, and the red is the number of fatalities in those crashes. So the trend has been downward, but, of course, it's not good enough. To give you a quick overview of the magnitude, I've got three maps here, and I put a square around areas where there were lots of crashes. This happens to be the Seward Highway. That shows where the Seward Highway Safety Corridor is and gives you an idea of how we came about to identify that. It's pretty much a patchwork of little dots. This is the Matanuska Valley. You see my box around the Parks Highway between Wasilla and Big Lake. Again, you can see how many crashes over this time period have taken place in that area. And this is the Sterling Highway, and you see the same sort of situation between Sterling and Soldotna, where the crashes have been much higher. By the way, the red are fatal crashes, and the blue are major injury crashes. This is an example of what we can do. I've been with the department since 82, and we've put a lot of time and effort into railroad crossing safety. And I put this in merely as an example of if everybody's working on it together, we've been able, in this situation, we've shown a lot of success in driving down crashes from highs in the 20 to 30 range to none or one. So we know that with the right focus, things are possible. Gordon mentioned the traffic safety corridor law that the legislature passed in 2006, and that allows us to designate corridors and, of course, produces the double fines. This is a really quick idea of what it takes for us to implement a safety corridor. I only put this in here to let you know that it's a cooperative effort. We work with the Department of Public Safety and the Alaska Highway Safety Office as the three major players. Before we would designate a highway safety corridor, all the agencies have to be able to come online, sign off on it, commit to their part of it. Because if only one agency, if it were just DOT out there putting up the signs, signs alone are not going to be successful. And so it's always been a cooperative effort for the four that we have to date. These were what we called in 2006, the five leading candidates, four of which are now safety corridors. We did look at statewide data. It just so happens that the Central Region has 70% or more of the fatal major injury crashes in the state. So the highest ranked locations are pretty much all in the Central Region. And of the five, Gordon talked about the criteria. The FNMI stands for fatal major injury crash rate, above the average, a rural major road with over 2,000 vehicles a day. And then we have to have the commitment of education and enforcement to go with that before we designate it.
Sure. Representative Holmes.
Thank you. I was just curious, since I can't quite see, what was the fifth? You list off the four that were actually designated.
I'm going to talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. So here are the safety corridors that have been designated to date. Seward Highway was designated in May of 06. That was the rollout corridor. Parks Highway was designated in October of 06. And the Sterling and Knick Goose phase were just implemented July 1 of this year. As to the fifth one, the Palmer-Wasilla Highway is the fifth one. And It is different from all the rest of the routes that are designated as safety corridors, as it's a lot more urban. The type of crash pattern are predominantly rear ends versus the head-ons. So the situation is different and did not lend itself as well to corridor status. There have been other things done there. We've, over the last few years, we've installed 8 new traffic signals in an attempt to create gaps in the traffic stream.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Martindale, it appears that you're only concentrating on state highways. Have any localities, any municipalities adopted a similar thing? We're mostly, a lot of us here are, of course, from Anchorage. I haven't seen anything like this at the local level.
The highway safety corridors, as used nationwide, are mostly intended for rural major highways. Now, it's not to say there isn't a law currently that would cover. The law just passed probably wouldn't apply to a lot of the rural or the urban highways. It could be done, but the effectiveness of such a thing in an urban environment, the crashes are different, the situations are different. And I am here to tell you, as the Highway Safety Improvement Program coordinator, I do look at all the crashes. In other words, I don't distinguish between state routes and local routes. In fact, a lot of the projects we nominate are on local streets because our money can be spent for any public road. So,
To follow up, Mr. Chair, are you going to address the local issue today so we can, as a legislature, take a look and see what can be done locally, whether regardless of whether it's here or in any of the other municipalities?
Because the discussion was limited for my presentation to the traffic safety corridors, it was not my intent to talk about the local situation. I'm certainly aware of it, but it isn't part of this presentation.
And Representative Grunberg, that was, I think, also the understanding of the chairs, is that we were going to focus primarily on these hot spots and on these highway corridors. And we certainly would love to get with you after this meeting to discuss.
Yes. I don't want to detract from this. I was just finding out what your plans were. This is fine, but I would like to follow up locally because that would be of interest, I think, to a lot of us here.
Okay. Representative Wilson, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron, up there, the very last one, the Palmer-Wasilla Highway, it is different, and you said because there were more rear-end crashes. Is that because do most of them happen in the wintertime? Is it because of icy roads or?
No. Actually, it's probably equal. The biggest situation where we have rear-end crashes that become fatal are vehicles stopped at a minor side street approach, hit from behind while waiting to turn where there isn't a turn lane, and frequently pushed into the oncoming lane. The people who stop to make a turn often kink their wheels in preparation for making their turn, and for whatever combination of reasons, somebody comes behind them, they're not paying attention. They strike them, and oftentimes with a really busy highway, if you do push them into the other lane, somebody's there for them to hit.
So basically, most of them are from one car is stopped, and another car hits them. So it's not in traffic. It's in a turning lane, then?
Well, that's one of the issues, is there where most of these happen, there isn't a turning lane. So the vehicle is actually sitting in the through lane, stopped, waiting to make a turn, and because the volumes are high enough, gaps during the day are harder to achieve. And if somebody is not paying attention, whatever combination of things they may or may not be doing, the following vehicle, they strike them.
Okay, thank you.
Talking about the traffic safety corridors, these are some maps of the crashes going all the way back to 1977 for the major corridors. This is the Seward Highway. You'll note, I point out to you that the ones with the blue boxes are impaired driving, either alcohol, drugs, or both. It's important to know they're a significant component here. This is the Parks Highway, same situation. You see between Wasilla and Big Lake, the crashes, the red are fatals, the green are major injuries, the white were fatals before the road was realigned. But again, there's a high percentage of impaired driving crashes here as well. This is the Sterling Highway between Sterling and Soldotna. And again, the blue represent impaired crashes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. Can you give us a breakdown of the
time of year for these fatal crashes?
They're pretty much, I've tried to look for a pattern to indicate whether these were winter or summer based, and I've never been able to establish that any one particular season. The Seward one could argue that the summer is a little higher because the seasonal volumes are so high and the chances of being struck by someone else if you're out of control are much greater. But by and large, these are year-round issues and are not limited to a certain time of the year.
If I might be
sure.
You mean that if there are, let's pick 60, which is the extrapolation for 2009, that in those 60 fatal crashes are going to be evenly distributed across the months?
Well, I would say there would be a peak in the summer for recreational-based routes, particularly the Seward Highway.
Yep.
Parks is a year-round one. So the Seward would have certainly an increase in the summer, but let's say the parks between Wasilla and Big Lake are fairly evenly distributed because the volumes don't really change much during the year. It's not as much of a recreational route.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, I'd like to see these statistics based
on
time of year. Month of the year would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. So, Ron, to follow on Representative Dugan, then your opinion will certainly pose this question to the public safety and the highway patrol. These accidents, you would say, then, are generally the causes of behavior and driving rather than road conditions, for instance. I think that's a little bit just to better articulate the point that Representative Dugan was making. I mean, those would be a layperson would contemplate those two issues. Traffic volume, we certainly understand seasonal peaks, but you would have road conditions, and then you would have driver behavior. And your point of view is that driver behavior doesn't change and that weather conditions do not contribute very much fatalities and major injuries.
No, I'm sorry. I would not say that the weather conditions don't contribute, but I guess the issue relating to weather conditions is drivers driving for the condition. In other words, when you have adverse weather conditions, Seward Highway is a great example, and you know that things are icy, but you're traveling on the tangent sections fairly fast, but you don't make a correction that occurs. We don't sign highways for the worst condition.
Mm-hmm.
We sign it for the prevailing condition or dry pavement condition.
Okay, thank you.
And lastly, this is the Kinnick-Goose Bay Road Corridor, which has the highest percentage of alcohol-related fatal crashes of all of the routes that I've looked at. I believe it may have something to do with the bar hours or the bar down at the end of the road, but this one has been notably a little higher than some of the others for that type. As I mentioned earlier, we use the what we call the three E's, education, enforcement, and engineering. The engineering things that we're working on, I'll cover that a little bit later as well, but as far as from a safety standpoint, low-cost, high-benefit safety improvements include such things as the improved signing and delineation, shoulder and centerline rumble strips, the kind of things to get people's attention. We're working on those. Mm-hmm. Under education, that stands for the Alaska Highway Safety Office. I apologize for those who didn't know that, spelling that out. They are responsible for providing funding for the educational campaigns, ads. They also provide money to the Department of Public Safety, which I'm sure they'll be talking about. And then enforcement with the troopers, the Bureau of Highway Patrol has recently started, and they're going to talk more about that. I'm just here to say that our department has contributed time and money to help with the Bureau of Highway Patrol because we recognize that enforcement was a great bang for the buck, and it was something worth putting money into.
And, Ron, statistically, because the longer I have the privilege of serving this body, the more I come to understand that we are driven by statistics seems to be the fuel that goes through our body. Is it more appropriate to ask public safety or to ask you about statistics that relate to the age of drivers that are in these accidents? Is that a statistic that that you gather? Obviously, younger drivers cause more accidents, and we're all familiar with that with the structure of insurance premiums. Do we see the same pattern? There's alcohol would be a dominant characteristic of accidents, as you said. Is age another one, or are these questions better for public safety?
Well, you can ask them. I have looked at the data and have broken it down in that manner. So I can tell you that the largest percentage seem to be males between the age of 25 and 35, seem to be driving a truck, and kind of significant percentage of the time do not appear to be belted in. So there, it's not to say that there aren't other high points, but significantly highest piece, if I was to group it in a 10-year age group, and those factors would be the 25 to 35-year-olds.
And what about alcohol? Is alcohol also a dominant characteristic in a lot of the accidents on all of these hotspots, or not necessarily more than other fatalities on local roads?
Statewide fatal accidents, the percentage is about 37% of fatal accidents involve some sort of impairment, whether it be alcohol or drugs. In the case of the safety corridors, the Seward is about average, and the Parks is about average, and the Sterling is a little below average. Kennett Goose Bay is above the average.
Okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Munoz?
What about statistics associated with cell phone usage or text messaging? Have you collected that data?
Well, there is a field on the crash form for cell phone use, and I will caution everyone, the problem with that is the officer pretty much has to witness the person on the cell phone, because it's unlikely that the person stopped is going to say, yes, not only was I on the cell phone, but I was talking to the person in the passenger seat and I was eating. And so I would have to say, even though we have the category, I would say the numbers are probably higher than the data indicates, because we don't really have a good way to track that unless it was witnessed. The other thing I wanted to say about the fatal crashes, there's a big belief, and last month I was down in Girdwood presenting crash data to the group down there, and there's a strong belief that a lot of these crashes are caused by passing, and I'm here to tell you that's not the case. We did have one on the Seward Highway this summer that where passing was happening at the time, but more often than not, it's not about passing. It's about some sort of distraction where someone crosses the center line, and it could be any number of distractions. It could be falling asleep. It could be the cell phone use. It could be you're talking to your passenger, reaching around to discipline your child. You can name any number of things, but when there is a passing maneuver, even when it isn't supposed to be happening, everybody is more acutely aware that it's going on. If you've ever been on the highway and you see two sets of headlights coming at you, everybody's reacting to it. The person in the opposite direction is starting to move to the shoulder. The person being passed is looking over, wondering why this guy's passing him here. And the guy passing has probably got white knuckles because he's trying to get around. Whereas a drifting crash on a high-volume road, there is no time to react. Seward Highway in the summer when we got 22,000 cars on it and someone isn't paying attention, the likelihood of striking someone in the other direction is quite high. But it isn't ordinarily about passing. And it was something I thought was important because people believe that, that passing is the root cause.
And then on that point for a moment, these are a definition again, rural highway corridors that are designed for more than 2,000 cars per day. And we have Parks and the Seward road during the recreation during the summer at 19,000 vehicles. So were we to make them into four-lane roads so that they no longer were defined as, the characteristics of a rural corridor, do you believe that that would have, and I'm not saying we have $600 million, Representative Wilson, I'm well aware, but would that have a very obvious effect on these accident statistics going forward if we were able to snap our fingers and have a four-lane highway in place? Would that be a characteristic that would change these statistics going forward significantly?
In the case of any head-on fatal crash, I'd have to say absolutely. Any sort of divided, we're talking not only four-lane, but some sort of positive dividers so that you can't drift into the other lane. Given those situations, some of the most spectacular crashes that we have would no longer occur if you couldn't get across to the other side. So obviously, to my way of thinking, that would be a very...
And to that end, a follow-on question is, can you rattle off the dates of when these highways were constructed? Because Alaska was a lot smaller, and I presume that the volume of traffic on these roads was more appropriate when these highways were first built.
Well, the Seward Highway, in its present configuration, with a few exceptions, was widened and straightened. If those who remember what it might have been like before with no shoulders, that all happened in the early 80s. There have been other projects since, the most notable being the Bird to Gird section that has the three lanes and all the rock blasting, and that was in the mid-90s. But otherwise, other than some smaller projects, when that was built, I want to say the ADTs were about a third of what they are now. In the case of the Parks Highway, the original Parks Highway was built and paved in, I believe, around 1970. The piece between Wasilla and Big Lake was realigned in the 90s in a couple of stages. But certainly, being two-lane, two-way, it was designed for what the traffic was at the time it was built. Kinnick-Goose Bay, the same thing. We did some recent improvements to that, I want to say about 3 years ago, where we widened the shoulders, added pathways. There's some work going on out there right now with a couple of new traffic signals. But the basic road alignment remains the same as it's been for years. The Sterling Highway was realigned extensively in the early 90s from its little narrow road, and at the time, right-of-way was purchased for it to eventually be a four-lane highway. That has not happened yet. We're working on some issues through my own highway safety program to try to address passing opportunities in the area. But needless to say, the dates of all the roads and basically their present alignment go back a number of years.
So Alaska has grown and the highway system hasn't. I mean, it's kind of the reality that we're contending with, that we still have rural corridors, but we have traffic volumes that are significantly higher than the original design of those rural corridors.
They certainly have not been able to keep up, yes. Some initial results from the traffic safety corridors that were done on the Seward Highway and the Parks Highway. One of the problems, and it isn't really a problem, but one of the issues, we try to track both fatal and major injury crashes in measuring the success of these, because fatal crashes are so cyclical, and you'll see in some graphs coming up, they vary so much from year to year that in order to measure progress, it's better to measure a larger sample size. To that end, on the Parks and the Seward, we only got full data, including all the major injuries, through 07, and those indicated we've had significant improvements, but as we all know, in the case of the Seward Highway, this year is certainly an exception. I can't tell you how many major injury crashes we've had, but in the corridor we've had, I believe, four fatal crashes this year. So we were seeing improvement. I think we still will, but having the nature of a fatal crash is such an anomaly sometimes. The circumstances are such that what vehicle were they in, how big was it, who hit them, did they have their seatbelt on, so many things that it's hard to... Those could go up, and we could still be saying we were having success. But it certainly, as you said earlier, the public is not at all happy with this and is tired of it, and I have to say we agree with them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grimberg.
Mr. Martindale, what does BHP stand for?
That's the Bureau of Highway Patrol, which started beginning of this year. I know the troopers are going to discuss that, too.
Okay.
Just a little discussion of the kind of things that that are being done currently on these safety corridors. There's a study on Kinnick-Goose Bay to look at expanding to four lanes. It is just a study at this point. The Parks Highway has a project that's actually going to four lanes, and I'm not sure that I know the schedule. I believe it's 2011 or 2012, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. We are looking at identifying more slow vehicle turnout opportunities. We are, of course, we just let and bid our Central Region Rumble Strip project, where the contractor will be putting in 300-some miles of shoulder rumble strips and 108 miles of centerline rumble strips in both.
How expensive is that, Mr. Martindale?
The rumble strips, the bid we got was about $500 or $600 a mile. So the whole project of 500 miles, I want to say it was $1.3 million was the low bidder.
And what about the four lanes sought for the Sterling expansion?
I don't have a good, I'd have to really guess that estimate for the Sterling. The Sterling does have the right-of-way because it was acquired for that. If I had to guess, I would have said a project in the range of $100 to $150 million, but I don't want to be held to that because I haven't done that estimate.
Today happens to be a day where we're talking about $40 million in highway funds based on an 8 cents a gallon tax. And so I suspect that throughout the day we are going to find many opportunities to spend $40 million increments that could be that are embedded either in deferred maintenance or new projects that relate to safety, either through public safety or through transportation. And I just want to bring that to the attention of our group because it certainly is staring me in the face. Madam Chair. And we've been joined by Representative Johnson also.
Ron, in the lower 48, many states have found that they cannot keep up with the growth by adding new highways. They have found that that just has not been able to work because they can't keep up, and so they're looking at mass transit and other ways to try to correct the situation. Does it look like that even if we had the money to do this, we're growing fast, or are we kind of staying ahead of it if we could do some of this?
Looking at the traffic volumes over the years, and we have permanent recorder stations that gather data all the time and tell us what they're doing, the last couple of years, the growth, as everyone's probably aware, hasn't been as high, but that could change at any time. It's pretty hard in this state to forecast where the volumes are going to go. If we suddenly have a gas pipeline, that all changes. That's the way it's been in this state, so we do our best to predict. I will say that if these major corridors were four-lane, a four-lane capacity would be accommodated for a number of years. I don't want to say how many because of the what might happen. We would gain a substantial amount of time on that, but it depends on the other background growth in the state.
Thank you. Your statistics on the growth in users on these highways, can you distinguish among passenger vehicles, commercial vehicles, and what I'll use for lack of a better term, tourism vehicles, so that we can get an idea of is there sort of disproportionate growth by sector, or is this across the board, or do the statistics allow us to find that out?
We do have, I can't quote you those right now, however, I can get that information.
Great.
We have classification locations that count by axles and can approximate commercial and recreational and passenger vehicles. We can get that information.
Yeah, great. If it's not too much trouble, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
May I follow up on that, please?
Representative Grimmer.
How about Alaskans versus non-Alaskans?
In the terms of crash data, it's impossible for us to tell. We don't get the personal information in the crashes, which is proper. We don't have a need for people's names and addresses. And also, as far as looking at crash data, I'm not able to tell you, except I might be able to guess that somebody had a rental car or something looking at that much data. But it's not real reliable. I can tell you that in terms of the fatal crashes that we have followed up on, the crash itself probably less likely involves a tourist. I won't say that somebody attempting to be impatient and get around the tourist hasn't had something to do with it, but I don't think that the tourist is a disproportionate percentage of these crashes. I just don't have a good way to document
it. I didn't mean to target tourists because somebody who's more familiar with a road may, in fact, be more reckless.
That is correct. It was
to be a neutral between residents and non-residents. I'm just interested in the facts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ron.
I'll quickly go over some of these statistics for each of the corridors. This is a history of Seward Highway. The red line is fatal crashes. The blue line is major injury. And the vertical blue line was when the safety corridor was designated, and the yellow line is traffic volumes. So when we discuss traffic volumes, you can see on the Seward Highway in 1977, the average traffic volume was around 3,000, and in 2008, it was around 9,000, so a 300% increase in a roughly 30-year period. Our fatal data through 2009 shows that we definitely have a bump. You see in 2008, we had in the corridor, four fatal crashes, and in 2009, we've had three so far in the corridor. This is the Parks Highway. Again, the same information. You can see what the traffic volumes are doing in the yellow line. You can see in blue the major injury crashes, and in red the fatal crashes. We had quite a spike in fatal crashes in 2005, so I'm wanting to say that the data on that road is looking considerably better in the last couple of years. We did have a fatal in 2009. We did not have any in 2008, but that contrasts to 5 that we had in 2005. Sterling Highway, kind of the same thing. We just now established the safety corridor, so it's too early to determine what the effect's going to be. The trend, however, of the volume has been up, and the trend of the crash severity has been down, although with the fatal crash, you see, I don't know why we had this huge peak in 1990. Right now, it's running around between 1 and 2 fatal crashes a year in that corridor. And Kinnick Goose Bay Road, the volumes have increased, while the major injury crashes, at least in 07, have dropped considerably. And the fatal crashes so far in 08 and 09 are 0. And Palmer Wasilla, kind of the same situation. It's a different kind of a highway, but our fatal crashes have been somewhat constant over the time period, while major injuries appear to have dropped and volumes have gone up. So these are some other ideas that people have suggested to us to help mitigate the crashes, including lowering the speed limits, concrete barriers, more no-passing zones, and there are some things we're actually doing, the centerline rumble strips and the delineation. We're working on those projects now. Traffic signals, that's being done on the Palmer-Wasilla Highway. We're looking at moose fencing on parts of the Sterling Highway where it works, and, of course, the four-lane divided question. In terms of speed limits, what I want to talk about a little bit is there's a lot of feeling that if we were to lower the speed limit, we could help solve this problem.
Sorry, Ron, could I ask you to go back to the last slide, please?
Sure.
I assume that a lot of these are public comments, and the public approached you. So can you just, you listed them off, and I appreciate that, but could you go through them and articulate those that are too expensive, those that are, you know, affordable options for the state, and those that actually would have a positive impact on the subject before us today, please?
Okay, and I've got coming up some slides that actually specifically addresses the speed and the barrier issue. I can talk about the others now, but
okay,
I am leaving.
I'll talk about the others then, and then we'll come back to
the
top two.
The creating no-passing zones, it's a great idea, but if people are already frustrated, you have to be careful what it is you're trying to do. If you create more of those and people are not willing to comply with a stripe on the highway, that you may risk a situation where you create more discontent in times of the day when it is possible to pass. In terms of, like I said, the rumble strips and delineation, we're doing those things. The traffic signals, we're doing those things. Moose fencing is a great idea in those areas, and I brought that in because the Parks Highway Corridor and the Sterling Highway Corridor have high percentages of moose crashes. The problem with fencing it is it also has a high percentage of driveways and intersections, meaning that no matter what you do with fencing, you're going to have holes all over it. And so the effect is not going to be what you'd like.
And on those points, before we proceed, there are members of the Alaska State Troopers in the room, but nevertheless, I will hazard that I have, from time to time, inappropriately gone over the speed limit. That being said, I am a person that's very mindful of no passing zones, and I never cross the double yellow line. And so, if we look at that one, because you know painting yellow lines is the least expensive, and it certainly has an impact on me. I just don't cross them. Driver's ed. I was taught that was unsafe. If we were to direct DOT to revisit more no-passing zones and to ignore your remark that it would create more discontent amongst drivers, it would have on me a very immediate effect because I just see that as a driver, as an instant safety issue. Is that something that we could direct DOT to come back to the legislature with because it's such an inexpensive fix and it would have such a positive effect on many drivers to not cross lines? Is that something that we could request you, Madam Chair? I would ask you as the Chair of Transportation how you felt about that, and then also direct the question to Ron.
A little looking into it and checking out what the facts would be and what the pros and cons would be, it would be definitely something we could lose.
Chairman, sir.
Johansson.
You're going to look into that. I'd like to know what the penalties are for passing in a double zone. If you paint it double and the penalty is $5, nobody's going to care. It's going to hurt. That might be a part of the conversation. We could get that information, too.
Okay. I think we'll take that up with public safety at the appropriate time. But that seems to be a very inexpensive item to explore, and one that many drivers, I think, observe because they contemplate their own personal safety. And that gets into the psychology of drivers, whether they're rarely worried about the other person, but they're often worried about themselves. I think it's just our nature. So anyway, go ahead. I appreciate you pausing for us.
Certainly. And in addressing a couple of these issues specifically, because they've come up the most, the one about speed limits. The basic premise of setting a speed limit is trying to set a limit that is to some extent self-enforcing, that people will believe makes sense to them, and so they will drive it so that it doesn't require constant and overwhelming enforcement to achieve that speed limit. I have a couple of examples. The roads that we changed to 65 miles an hour several years ago, before we changed them, almost everyone was exceeding virtually everyone was exceeding the posted speed limit. There's a common belief that when you raise a speed limit, for example, that people will drive 10 miles an hour faster. We did not find that to be the case on the roads that we raised. We did have some increase. The Glen Highway has gone up a few miles an hour. The Seward's gone up a couple of miles an hour. We monitor those every year. But they didn't automatically go up 10 miles an hour. Now, I have some other examples of routes that we lowered the speed limit that either or have a low speed limit that people don't wish to comply with. And you could probably compare this to some extent to no passing zones as well, because you've got we had a speed limit briefly a couple of years ago near Homer that we were asked to reduce to 45, and it lasted 2 weeks before the outcry was so great that we had to come and remove it. In our Willow 45-mile-an-hour zone, we get very low compliance even today. Minnesota Drive is about to go to 60 miles an hour because the 85th percentile speeds are all, the higher speeds are in the mid-60s. The Glen Highway, as we all know, they're actually up in the 70s now. And one of the examples that probably worked the least well is we were asked to lower the speed limit in Cooper Landing in the narrow, windy road to 35. We studied that regularly, and the speeds are closer to 50. And we have not been able to achieve with fines that kind of reduction.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, there's maybe it's too close to lunch. I don't get what you're trying to tell me when you say close speed grouping desired least conflict.
Okay, let me expand on that. The goal of a speed limit is to get as many people as possible to drive at or near the same speed. And the advantage to that is you don't have people getting impatient, trying to pass, do other maneuvers. If the drivers have all voted on the speed limit and they all drive nearly the same speed, you have a lot less incidence of aggressive and reckless driving. So the idea of what we call the pace is trying to keep as many vehicles as possible into a narrow band of speed.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. So in this example, you're getting that desired result more at a 65 mile an hour speed limit than at a 55.
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Representative Grimberg.
I missed what you said about Minnesota Drive. Would you please repeat that?
We have been actually looking at that for 10 years now about the speed limit. The operating speeds out there have been close to the mid 60s for years now.
Now, where are we talking about on Minnesota?
Okay, we're talking from south of Tudor, basically near International, all the way around to near Old Seward Highway.
Okay, go ahead.
That piece. The speeds we've monitored out there have been anywhere between 63 and 65 miles an hour. And as anyone who drives that will tell you, APD spends a lot of time out there, and they still drive at those speeds. So we are actually in the process. We've gone through the whole public process, went to the communities, gotten everything signed off on, and we're about to raise the speed limit on Minnesota from south of Tudor to west of Old Seward to 60 miles an hour.
I see. second question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Going down on the Seward Highway, basically, it seems that, I'm just talking now as a motorist, that there's a lot of frustration because some people drive very slowly. Are you going to discuss that?
Well, it's correct that some people do drive slowly, and there's been a lot of discussion I've seen in the paper and the blogs and all lately about people wanting to get around these slow vehicles and how they're hampering and they're causing them to be impatient. Although no one forces someone who's stuck behind someone to execute an unsafe maneuver to get around them, what we are looking at is, I was just down on the highway last week, we're trying to find low-cost spots that we can build more turnouts, because we certainly know that that's an issue. It's hard to expect slow vehicles to get off the road if we don't have enough places for them to do it. And I'm not talking about a pullout with two driveways. They won't, we're talking about a parallel lane. So we recognize that, and we're trying to see how many of those in areas where it's easy enough to do that we can insert.
And if I may, right now the law says you have to pull over if there are five vehicles behind you. Have you ever thought about lowering that to four vehicles, seeing if that would have an effect?
I've not addressed that issue. I mean, I hadn't even thought about it. It's pretty much most states in the country that do it have used five. I honestly can't tell you where the five came from or whether that would make a difference. It might.
It'd be something to think about.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg, we appreciate the question. Representative Duke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there been any consideration to establishing minimum speed limits as well as maximums?
Currently, I don't believe we have anything on the books or in our manuals and all that either allow us or facilitate us posting minimum speed limits at this time.
If you might, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I know for a fact that in some places where they have similar problems, like Hawaii, where they don't have very much in the way of roads and a lot of traffic, that in some places they have established minimum speed limits as a way of mitigating the conflict between people who want to drive under the speed limit and everybody else. Is there any reason that you know of that we couldn't do that here to some effect? I don't think anybody wants to change the law just to change it, but...
There's no, I can't think of a reason why that can't be considered. You know, obviously, a lot of other states use it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just one question to follow up. Remember? Yeah, I would very much like you to follow up with that. There, as far as you know, and I'm sort of asking the folks from both departments this, there's no legal impediment to your establishing minimum speed limits. Am I correct?
I'm not aware of any. I might not be the best authority on that, but from what I know, I'm not aware.
If I could ask somebody in the departments to address that either now or later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. The other issue I wanted to visit with a little bit of discussion is there's been a whole lot of discussion in the traffic safety corridors where there have been head-on fatal crashes to simply put in a concrete barrier, and certainly that would be a very useful thing to do to keep people from hitting each other in opposite directions. What I'm here to discuss, however, is for the one upside, there is about a dozen downsides that may indeed make things worse, not the least of which is in this example you see, this happens to be the Seward Highway, but in this example you see we have 12-foot lanes and 8-foot shoulders. In order to make a barrier system work, you have to have what we call shy distance to the barrier. So when you put a barrier in the middle down the yellow line, now you've got to move the lanes away, and then you have to narrow the shoulders. So now you've got, let's say, 4-foot shoulders instead of 8-foot shoulders. And the reason this becomes important is I'm going to show you these pictures. These are the things that everybody's aware of that happens on the highway. So when you're thinking about those kind of, when one contemplates those kind of decisions, they need to be aware of the impacts. And those, among those, are these kinds of activities that go on all the time that if we reduce the shoulder, they would still go on, only there wouldn't be room for them. In the case of a barrier, it's in itself, it's a hazard when you hit it and you bounce off of it.
no one will ever be able to pass anywhere this barrier is, so there's certainly a frustration factor there. There's a safety factor related to emergency vehicle responses that if once something happens on the other side, you can't get to it. There's also the necessity in many instances to have a break in the median for people to make left turns. Two problems with that. The barrier nose itself is a big hazard, and as soon as somebody stops to make a left turn, nobody gets around them. So even though it sounds good for the first few seconds that someone talks about it, there's a number of reasons. You know, people have asked us, well, why don't you do it? Isn't it obvious? Well, it is until you start thinking about it.
Because you're modifying a rural highway corridor that wasn't designed for that with a vehicle count now that is far in excess of what a rural highway corridor is designed for.
That's correct. And where they have, where barriers have been used, and there's a lot of studies that say they're a great idea, why don't you just do it? The studies are on generally four-lane roadways, that you don't see this done very often at all on a roadway like this.
Very helpful. Thank you.
So what are we doing? In addition to the traffic safety corridors, we've worked with the state troopers and the Bureau of Highway Patrol. We've worked with the Alaska Highway Safety Office, which is a unit of DOT that have provided funding for education and enforcement activities. And then I briefly talked about a couple of projects we've got going. Is our Rumble Strip project, where the work is going to begin early next spring. What you see here on these maps, all the red places are places that are getting centerline rumble strips, all the safety corridors, and some other high head-on crash locations. And I'm working on a project right now. We looked at the system-wide rural highways and looked at where the concentration of crashes are, and to no one's surprise, when it comes to single-vehicle crashes, they often happen on curves where people are coming in them too fast. So we're looking at a project to improve all the delineation, come up with a hierarchy of delineation schemes so that people driving along tangent, the more you have to slow down, the maybe higher level the devices are, even including things like transverse rumble strips that wake you up or whatever. So that's another project we're working on. And that's the end of my formal presentation.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a constituent in the audience who passed me a question he asked me to ask. Have you ever considered on some of these building alternate routes as opposed to widening highways or putting if we're exceeding the capacity on some of these, obviously one idea is to widen it. Another is to consider alternate roadways.
Well, I can only address, obviously, in terms of the Seward Highway, that's a pretty tough one.
Yeah. There's
too
a cliff.
Many alternatives, the ocean on one side, the mountains on the other, and the railroad and the blue goods mm-hmm. and everything else. On the Palmer Wasilla, in fact, the Mat-Su Borough is working on the Bogard Road extension, which is a parallel road to the Palmer Wasilla Highway, which hopefully will provide some relief to the Palmer Wasilla Highway. In terms of the Sterling Highway, you've kind of got the same issue where you're surrounded by either private land or to the north, National Wildlife Refuge land. And so it's not that it couldn't be done. There are some definite large obstacles to getting around that. The Parks Highway, there's been a number of discussions over the years. I'm not the expert on this, but as far as Wasilla bypasses where it would come back in, and those continue to happen, there are certainly possibilities there. The Knick Goose Bay Road, you know, we are making a lot of other connections to it, either from Big Lake Road or from Vine Road, or there's a number of other ways. They're not going to relieve immediately the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All of our discussion here is basically about South Central Alaska and the other place where they got roads in a relatively large population is in the Fairbanks area. So apparently they're not having the same kinds of problems that we're having, and if that's the case, why not?
It's true that 70% of the fatal major injury crashes are in our region, mainly because of the population. We have the lion's share of the population. In terms of Fairbanks, they've had the fortunate circumstances over the years, I like to say, to get their highway system built up to a level that they have excess capacity, and it certainly helps them. It's not to say they don't have their problem areas. When working with the Bureau of Highway Patrol to define high crash areas,
I looked at all over the state. We didn't limit the work, even though I'm a central region person. We looked all the routes in the state. But when you look at where the severe crash is, the highest northern region one maybe comes in at number 40 in the list of locations, as far as breaking it down to small segments of highway. Not that they don't have their issues, and at any given time, I mean, there was just a fatal up there, I think, last weekend involving a motorcycle and a guardrail. So these things do happen, but they don't have nearly the capacity-constrained roads that we have. They've been able to build more multi-lane roadways in areas where they needed them than we have.
Thank you.
Yes, we also haven't had population growth for reasons that wouldn't be appropriate to discuss here, but assure you that they are energy-driven. Chair Wilson.
Ron, are those roads up there, are they able to make them straighter? Are they straighter roads?
Well, in the interior, I mean, I don't want to speak for the other regions too much.
I'm
but
thinking of Fairbanks.
Yeah, obviously the terrain maybe in some cases isn't as much of a deterrent, but a lot of it is if the traffic volumes are lower, the type of crashes that we're getting where if you drift out of your lane, you're going to hit somebody are not the kind of things in their rural system that they get as much because there's so much more headway between vehicles there.
Ron, we appreciate your expert presentation today. We do have a third of the Alaska State House convened here. Where is the commissioner this morning? I didn't want to play stump the traffic engineer.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
And I apologize for being late. Did you discuss the seasonality of this? And I'm wondering when we're designing roads, do we look at maximum capacity or average capacity? Because I know when you close the salmon runs in the valley, there's a lot of pressure to go south. So when we actually look at design of roads, are we looking at an average capacity once again, or a maximum? So can you address that a little bit, or is there an answer to that?
Well, it's somewhere in between. You don't necessarily design for the absolute peak summer fishing weekend, for example. But you do design, there are things known as like the 30th highest hour, or there are several criteria, or the peak hour, or so we do, when designing a new facility, if we have the luxury of designing it to meet the future capacity, which is not the case on the Seward Highway and some of these other routes, it would be designed with a peak volume in mind. The roads we're talking about, of course, are behind that curve. And your question about seasonality, the crashes pretty much happen year-round. The difference would be in the winter, people driving too fast for the conditions tend to be, so there is a winter component, but are there more of them in the winter than the summer? No.
Follow up and then represent your answer.
I can wait.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You actually stole my question. I was wondering if the commissioner was invited. I assume he was. If he's online listening, if he's taken part in this whatsoever. We're in Anchorage. Commissioner lives in Anchorage. It's an extremely important issue for South Central, and I see Commissioner Masters here. I don't know where the commissioner. I'm not sure half this committee could identify the commissioner if he were in here. So I'm just wondering where he's at. What's more important?
Frank, you better get up here fast. The house is on fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Ramos and Chairman Wilson. For the record, I'm Frank Richards, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The commissioner had a previously scheduled engagement. He actually had time off. So it was a scheduled vacation period for him, and he's exercising his opportunity to enjoy Alaska in the summertime. So I'm here representing the commissioner and the governor's office for this scheduled meeting, and hopefully the information that Ron and Gordon are providing to you will be able to answer the questions that the members may have on this very troubling topic.
Excellent. Frank, how about no passing zones? Can we get to work on identifying corridors that would benefit from no passing strips? That was the least expensive, most immediate solution that I heard today, notwithstanding the discontent it would create amongst some of our population of drivers. Is that something that we could look forward to getting something from DOT on, do you think?
Mr. Chairman, I took your request very seriously. We have our assistant AG here in the audience today, and so he and I will be convening on this after that.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since you're hitting, I'll ask you a couple of questions. Is it the department's position that the programs, including the construction programs that we're doing in the state of Alaska, are improving traffic throughout the state?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, the programs that we have regarding our highway infrastructure improvements are certainly to try and improve the traffic flow. The areas of congestion that Ron talked about specifically, for example, the Parks Highway corridor from Wasilla to the Big Lake intersection, is a project where we are actually looking at a four-lane highway to improve and reduce the fatality major injury accidents that we have in that area. We have improvements on the Seward Highway from 36th Street south down towards Rabbit Creek. We have the Connect Anchorage initiative, where we're looking to provide new east-west corridor connections to relieve the traffic flow from Tudor and across. So we do have programs we're initiating or that have been initiated, and we're trying to match up those major project funding needs with available funding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me try that question again. It's my impression, and the general impression, I think, of the people who live in South Central, that we've killed a bunch of people on the highway going south from here. And what I'm asking is whether or not what we're doing now is making it less likely that people are going to get killed on those highways in the first instance. And in the second, what is it that can be done, particularly on the Seward Highway, to lower the possibility that some citizen who's just driving along at the speed limit is going to get killed, which has happened more than once this summer?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, the department takes very seriously the fatalities and the tragic accidents that have occurred over this summer. It is truly in our mission. Our mission statement is to provide for the safe movement of people and goods. We have in place, and what Gordon was going to present to you next was going to be those near-term and mid-term options that we have funded for projects to be able to address and provide for safer routes. Ron identified the three E's: enforcement, engineering, and education, that we are undertaking to try and help Alaskans and our visitors know what they need to be able to do and what we are doing to try and provide them with safe transportation systems. The rumble strips are in design and will be put out for construction and under construction, I think, next summer is what Ron said. We have funds from the legislature as well as with the GO bonds for Windy Corner on the Seward Highway. We have the design efforts for the base of Turnagain Hill through to 75 to 90 towards Girdwood to provide for improvements in that portion of the Seward Highway. There are several projects in the tens of millions of dollars that are also on the design books. The challenge that we have facing us is going to be funding of those projects. We are and have been taking advantage of the federal funds, the highway safety improvement dollars that Ron has identified to be able to address those needs. Our biggest challenge is going to be those funds to be able to do the next larger projects. I spoke with the Senate Transportation Committee last week about our needs out there, identified our highway safety corridor needs across the state, as well as our capacity needs within our urban areas. Our challenge is going to be that the federal highway bill sunsets at the end of this month, the end of September. We don't know what's going to happen to us in 2010 in terms of the funding for the federal highway dollar. Federal highway dollars provide us the funds that we use to do our major safety improvements. There is a bill that has passed out of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, the authorization for the next six-year highway program. That bill is not beneficial to Alaskans. Alaska will be not able to achieve approximately 20% of the funding from that bill because it focuses on providing congestion relief in urban areas with populations of greater than 500,000. So we have huge needs out there. We have funding challenges to be able to meet our highway safety and program. But we're working with the legislature, with Representative Wilson's Transportation Committee, as well as with the Senate Transportation Committee, to try and find ideas to be able to advance our programs and provide for a safe transportation system.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Frank, I have a question because when Ron was talking about the possibility of what we could do, what the state could do for improvements, nothing was mentioned about cameras. And I don't know what a speed camera would cost, but it seems to me that that would be much cheaper than putting another trooper out there. And so could you go into that a little bit? Have you thought of it? How expensive is it? And is that even on your radar screen?
Yes, Chairman Wilson. The Department of Transportation and the Department of Public Safety, in conjunction with the governor, have been looking at the issues along the Seward Highway and looking for what are immediate, near-term, and medium-term options to be able to improve the safety. That's a discussion that Commissioner Masters and I had last week to look at what are technological advancements that we may use to help him in terms of enforcement. So photo radar is an option that has been out there and used by other states. We are looking and researching at what the legislation may be to provide us that ability to use those technologies. So I will pass the buck, so to speak, but I'll ask that Commissioner Masters, when he talks, be able to present about what technologies they may be able to use in their enforcement options.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And Frank, finally, before we move to public safety, I hear you say that there's a relationship between funding DOT projects and safety. So where is DOT on maintaining the 8-cent a gallon gas tax that goes into effect today versus putting it on a holiday for another 12 months? Does DOT have a position on that?
Chairman Ramirez, the governor has expressed the administration's position, and I will leave it at that.
So funds are still hard to come by for DOT to satisfy the safety requirements for the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, we've been, as I said earlier, been relying primarily on the federal highway dollars to be able to advance our program. We get specific monies for highway safety improvement dollars, and we've been using those to address, again, the areas where we have major traffic incidents and knocking those off. The state dollars that we get from general fund legislation are pretty much specific project appropriations. We don't have a program to build on to be able to address specifically safety needs. When we have a project that we advance that is a safety-related project, we present it through the administration to the legislature and seek the appropriation funding in that regard.
But you said federal highway funds are going to become more scarce going forward because of a population basis, and yet we've established that Alaskans have less tolerance for fatalities on the road, so we seem to have some inconsistent objectives.
Mr. Chairman, I would say nationally, Americans are less tolerant of fatalities and major accidents. There's an astounding figure of almost 42,000 people die each year on America's highways, and the goal of the Federal Highway Administration and the state DOTs is to reduce those fatalities. You've seen the numbers that Ron showed you where we have shown significant improvement, if you can say that, on the reduction of the amount of fatalities. We are continuing to focus on that.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we move on to another department, we heard some presentations in transportation, I think it was last year, about there needing to be $1 billion spent on infrastructure for the pipeline. So talk a little bit about that. Is any of that part of this? Is that when we have increased commerce, if in fact there is a pipeline, are we looking at that? I know rumble strips are not going to do anything for big trucks when we're talking about that kind of issue. One,
And number two, in terms of the no passing and the four lane, if 10% of our accidents are head-on collision, would four lane fix that, and would no passing fix that? And proportionally, which would, if you can, or maybe the engineer is a better person to answer that. So two widely diverse questions. But before we move to another department, I'd like to at least put it on the table that we do have $1 billion of infrastructure needs before we can drive a truck across some of the bridges that are going to haul some of the pipe to get this pipeline. And so where does that fit in? I mean, $600 million is a lot of money, but it's not that much when you start talking about $1 billion shortfall statewide.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, you've heard me speak before about the gas line infrastructure needs, and statewide, when I looked at the highway system from Prudhoe Bay east to the border, was approximately $2 billion. So when we look at the needs statewide.
And you said billion. I just want to be clear that that was not an M.
Billion with a B.
Thank you.
B is in Bravo. As I presented.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and that's just from Prudhoe to the border.
That's correct.
And that doesn't include pipe coming in the Haines or pipe coming in Anchorage. So it doesn't include Anchorage to Fairbanks?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it actually did include the Haines Highway. There was about a $40 million project on the Haines Highway for improvement of the Chilkat River Bridge. But it did not include that portion of the Parks Highway, where you would see if you had pipe movement running by truck up the Parks Highway. So in that regard, we are looking, though, at the Parks Highway corridor, number one, for weight restriction eliminations, because our interior communities are impacted seasonally by the weight restrictions that we place on those, that all the roads in Alaska, but particularly the Parks Highway, because it's such a heavy freight corridor for goods flowing into Fairbanks and then off onto other communities. We do have a desire to be able to improve the Parks Highway with sound enough embankment and surfacing so we would not have to have a weight restriction on it seasonally, which would allow 100% legal loads year-round. That project, it would be considered a need for a gas pipeline. But in talks with the producers, most of the major pipe haul, we're told, would be by rail coming in from either Seward or Anchorage to be able to move through that corridor. But in regards to what we're talking about, highway traffic safety improvements and the gas line needs, $2 billion initial need identified for, again, that corridor, the Dalton Highway, the Rich, and the Alaska Highway, almost $1 billion when you consider the full build-out to a four-lane divided on the Seward Highway and those other corridors like the Parks, the Sterling, and Kinnickus Bay. So those right there represent a $3 billion need statewide. When you talk about head-on collisions, as Ron indicated earlier, when you are able to divide the traffic flow and go to a four-lane road, you essentially do away with the head-ons because you've prevented folks then from crossing that center line to be able to provide for that head-on. Those are expensive options. The passing zones that we talked about, the use of chevrons and lowering speed limits, those are all concepts that we need to look collectively at with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation.
Representative Johnson and then Representative Johansson, and then we'll move on.
And my point was that I appreciate that the four lanes would alleviate the head-ons, but we're talking 10% of the crashes. I mean, didn't I hear that 10% of the crashes were head-on?
If I could clarify that.
Ron, if you come up and put on the record.
What I said was 10% of the head-on fatals involved a passing maneuver at the time of the crash, but that there is a substantial number of head-on fatals that involve someone drifting across the center line.
Okay.
So there is a difference. So it is a larger number than 10%. I just merely meant to imply that 10% was people engaged in passing maneuvers at the time of the crash.
Do we have that number? The drifting over into the other lane as opposed to passing?
Well, yes. What I've looked at in the data, it suggests that over 90% of the head-on fatals involves something other than passing. Exactly what that is, why they drifted, I don't necessarily have enough data in all cases to know that. But there are
fields on the crash form that the officer uses to say, what was the vehicle doing at the time of the crash? And we use that as a basis, was he passing or was he not passing? And the data we've looked at, several years of data, passing was only involved in 10% or less, where there was actually a passing maneuver at the time of the crash.
Okay. Representative Johansson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, Frank, and I don't need an answer right now, but if you could get this information. On your 3E approach joint effort, I'd like to know, on number one, signs, stripes, rumble strips, and number two, TV, radio advertising, message boards, holidays, and road safety campaigns, what your funding sources are for those, if indeed general fund is used in any of those programs, or is this all strictly pure federal money with no state match or no state dollars involved? That would be interesting to follow up on the chairman's comment about the gas tax. Thank you.
Through the chair, we will provide the funding that we've used for those efforts, yes.
Frank, always a pleasure to have you with the committee. We thank you. And Ron, we thank you for an exceptional presentation. I think we all learned a great deal. And also, we thank you, Gordon. Representative Gruenberg, we also thank you for the extraordinary question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to put on the record that I appreciate the job you gentlemen have done here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Frank. Commissioner? Commissioner Masters, we're very happy to have you before the committee today, and we thank you for your preparation and bringing so many folks from the field with you. We look forward to your presentation. Welcome.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And as you pointed out, I did bring a number of folks with me to help with our discussion. First off, thank you very much for holding the hearing so we can discuss highway safety and discuss how we are able to affect the number of crashes on our highways and reduce those numbers. Who I brought with me originally was Colonel Holloway, Colonel Audie Holloway, the director of the Alaska State Troopers, as well as Captain Hans Brinke, who's the captain over the newly formed Bureau of Highway Patrol, so he's the commander of that unit, as well as Lieutenant Barry Wilson, who was formerly stationed in Girdwood and also is currently in charge of our public information office. Unfortunately, Colonel Holloway had to leave because of another scheduled commitment, which is actually another extremely important issue, Department of Public Safety, and that was meetings regarding how to handle sexual abuse of minors. So he's not able to provide comment or answer questions. However, he has, I know, talked very at length with myself as well as his staff, and I believe he's also asked Lieutenant Wilson maybe to offer some comments that he wanted to make sure got conveyed. Excuse me. Also, before I get into the comments, I wanted to also introduce you to my new deputy commissioner, who's Robert Gorder. He's back in the audience here. Deputy Commissioner Gorder brings a lot of experience to the department, and he's going to be a wonderful asset to DPS, and I know we'll work closely with you in the future as well. The Department of Transportation, in their presentation, outlined the issue and the problem, the corridors, and all of that very nicely, and I know that as far as what we had for scheduled time is probably diminished a little bit, so I'm going to make my comments a little more brief and to some points that he did not, I don't want to not say that he did not, but from our perspective, DOT talked a lot about the roadways, the road services, those type of things that affect the crash rate. And what they outlined is a pretty good picture, I believe, that it was painted in what DPS's role in reducing crashes is. And that is the number one issue and single largest factor in serious crashes on our highways is driver behavior. And that's where DPS is most significant in its role. Holding dangerous drivers accountable is the most effective way that we do that. And we already know that the most effective enforcement component to reduce crashes is sustained high visibility enforcement and actually having troopers on the roads writing citations with fines attached to them. And data would show and studies would show that the most effective deterrent is a pocketbook deterrent to aggressive driving behaviors. We at Public Safety take highway safety extremely serious, and I know that DOT has already said this in their presentation, that although that the numbers of crashes are actually on a decline statewide and on the Seward Highway as well, and although that the number of DUI-related crashes is on a decline, as a matter of fact, I think from a performance standpoint, the numbers for 2009 that we're seeing now is that DUI-related crashes account for 21% of the fatalities.
Commissioner, may I interrupt you for a moment? I don't want to gloss over something that you just said. You talked about pocketbook. And for the members that are assembled here that haven't sat on the Judiciary Committee, I think one of the more interesting subjects that we've discussed over the last number of years is when it comes to domestic violence, which is, you know, such a significant issue in the state of Alaska. Oftentimes, behavior, human behavior, you know, at that point of rage, you know, where the match is lit, and violence is going to be committed, and assault is going to be committed. It is often not. It's recognized that it's often not a deterrent for that enraged person to decide, okay, is this going to be a Class A misdemeanor or is this going to be a C felony? It doesn't really go through the head of the enraged person when they're about to commit a crime. So what I'd like to ask you, Commissioner, before we proceed is the psychology of a driver is a lot different. You know, there are likely no abusive spouses here or serial assaulters at this table. But there may be some speeders at this table. That was Dahlstrom, by the way, gentlemen. Dahlstrom, D-A-H-L. Can you just extrapolate that for a moment, please, about the difference between you know, what we would all perceive as a pocketbook for points or for monetary fines. Versus, you know, behavior, you know, for people that are assaulting others or committing violent crimes, just so we can kind of put a freeze frame on the psychology of a driver versus the way we handle other law enforcement issues.
Mr. Chairman. Before I start, though, I believe for the record you'd already confessed to speeding prior.
With me.
I was paying attention. Comments. I'm not a psychologist, but I'm certainly a driver, and I'm certainly a driver also has had speeding tickets in my background as well, unfortunately. But what we believe, and I think it's supported by data nationwide, is that you probably relate this back to your dealing with your own children as well, is that the more immediate the punishment or the correction, the more likely that correction is actually going to change behavior. And I think with drivers, it's the same way. When drivers get stopped for speeding, for example, we'll use that one, if we give them a warning, that generally does not change the driving behavior. They just say, well, next time, you know, I know I got away with it this time, I might get away with it next time, so it doesn't necessarily, but for a few people, change driving behavior. But when you actually give them a citation that has points and has fines attached to it, the most immediate of the two is the fines. They recognize immediately that it's going to cost them because you actually write that number down, and they see that. The fines, I believe the points may be a little bit different. That's more of a delayed effect where it's cumulative points before a suspension, or they may not, the more aggressive drivers that lose their license may not care that they even lost their license anyway. But certainly the pocketbook issue is a significant one. There are studies, I believe, nationwide that show that, especially in the drivers between the ages of, say, 20 and 30, that is probably the single most effective way to reduce crashes is through that method.
Thank you, Commissioner Chairwell.
Sure.
Thank you. Commissioner, especially in our safety lanes, I think we've got caps on what that amount is. And so are you saying, what I'm hearing you saying is that if a trooper stops them and that amount is low, they're not going to be quite as excited as if that amount was higher. Do you think it would make a difference for us to take the caps off some of those?
Through the chair, I believe that's a discussion we need to have, whether or not that would be an effective way to deter the more aggressive of driving behaviors. I believe currently, and I don't want to go on record as a quote saying the cap is $300, but it's probably somewhere in that neighborhood. And I think that as well as other things should be discussed for future. And a part of our plan moving forward on dealing with highway safety is we're looking at a number of things to reduce the accidents and change these driving behaviors, one of which is trooper presence, certainly. Another is application of technology, regulation review as well, which regulations do we need to take a look at, what can we add that may enhance safety, are there some that need to be changed or some that need to be eliminated, and then certainly public education.
Thank you, Commissioner. And we do have Representative Gatto's seat, so I would encourage Representative Millett or Representative Olson to join us at the table if you want to draw straws. Representative Johansson, you have a question?
Thank you. I think this is probably the appropriate time to ask my question that was inappropriately brought up to the wrong department. On fines, where are we at kind of in the continuum across the 50 states? Are we pretty weak? Are we in the middle? Are we pretty tough? If hitting the pocketbook is what helps, where are we at? Are we hitting the pocketbook?
Through the chair, we had started looking into that nationwide. I've heard a couple of things from my staff that tend to make me believe that Alaska is probably in the lower half of fine amounts nationwide. I know that there's certainly some states, you know, I know that Washington, for example, has a lot higher fine amount, especially base fines, than Alaska does, and I think there's a number of other states. I haven't actually seen a specific study that sees where we rank in those amounts, but anecdotally, I believe it's probably in the lower.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to some more detailed information when we get back to Juneau.
Representative John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, and I thought the maximum fine was $600. It is in a safety corridor, but $300 in the rest of the area. So in the double fine, you can have $600. So that's not an insignificant amount, but when you're talking about life and death situations, maybe it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Commissioner, you're the DPS, I know you want to make your presentation, and we do anticipate going over in order to accommodate this presentation, mindful of the 2 o'clock hearing. Right now, DPS has a very significant campaign, because I'm a TV watcher, you know, for Click It or Ticket with the little children. It's a great campaign.
Yeah.
It's very effective.
Yes.
And it's nice. It frames an issue. Although I voted against that bill, and I got ticketed for not wearing my safety belt by a trooper in Fairbanks, and he's a nice guy. But I told him, I said, you know, I voted against that bill, and he looked at me like I was a crazy person. You know?
You're kind of thoughtful, aren't you?
Yeah. And but Commissioner, do we have PSA campaigns that are directed toward, or could we direct them toward, greater fines for, you know, these hot spots that exist on these four highways? I know we have some double fine zones, but, you know, can Click It or Ticket really has to do with my safety, but speeding has to do with, you know, the safety of the driver, you know, that may be very law-abiding, you know, to the left or to the right of me. And do we have the ability to focus on a PSA campaign on that issue? Is that part of one of the three E's that DOT is doing? Do we have a similar program with public safety?
Mr. Chairman, actually, of the three E's, of course, DOT covers the engineering aspect, and we cover the enforcement aspect, extremely heavily funded by Alaska Highway Safety Office funding, which is federal funding. And then the E part of that, the education part of the E's, is done jointly. Although Highway Safety Office provides the majority of the funding, We provide the folks that actually produce the ads, make the ads, come up with the ideas, and then we schedule which ones we're going to campaign in conjunction with or in consultation with DOT. So it's actually a joint effort. And more to your question, we actually have a very wide assortment of public safety ads and campaigns that deal with a variety of issues, not just
they put it or ticket, although that's probably one of the more notable that people remember. But we have headlight ones. We have some that are that involve ready. We have some that are speeding related, no passing zone, or the delay of five vehicles. Those type of things. We have a wide variety of them. And what I propose is, I know we have a pretty lengthy PowerPoint presentation, and I would like to have Captain Brinke and Lieutenant Wilson come up and present that.
Yes, sir.
And I would be available certainly for any questions that you have afterwards. But before they come up, I do want to highlight one important piece of our effort towards highway safety, and actually what I think is the cornerstone of what we're doing to date, and that is the creation of the Bureau of Highway Patrol. Probably the most important thing we've done probably in the last two decades.
Yes, sir. Representative Dawson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to make a comment. The simulated accidents that you do at the high school are incredibly successful as far as reaching, you know, those young students who are developing habits right now and creating communication between parents and, you know, you did one at, or were involved with one at Chugiak High School this last year that was, I'm still hearing about. They're incredible. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you for your comment. And, yes, this, what you're referring to, I believe, is the Every 15 Minutes campaign,
yes.
Which is done in conjunction with the high schools and with the Highway Safety Office. And both Commissioner Von Schaben, DOT, and myself are participating in several of those upcoming ones.
Sure. Have you concluded, or do you have a...
I'm just waiting for your approval to bring up my two.
Commissioner, they're ready to go, and then I want to keep everybody on the record because I don't want us to scatter. But Jane does need a couple of minutes to hook up the PowerPoint, so perhaps we can talk amongst ourselves on the record about some of our objectives. And while we do this, I'm afraid to take a break for fear of...
yeah, don't.
Right.
No.
Right.
Chairman, I'd like to hear more about your infractions.
We don't have enough time.
Are you talking about when you're talking about the teenagers? Is that the one where they're talking on the phone and then it just, everything just goes crazy?
Oh, well,
yeah. Oh, I haven't seen that.
We're doing it for this. And what you didn't say is legislators are invited to participate. You encourage to participate in the school.
We're still on the record, so I'm just going to pretend that we're doing it that way. Representative Millett?
So anyway, and legislators are encouraged to participate in that program. It doesn't have to be a school in your district, but every 15 minutes they're looking for adults.
Oh, really?
People to participate.
Oh, interesting.
What do you do, go to the school?
You play either a victim, or you facilitate the students playing a victim, or role-playing. Actually, Nancy probably has participated.
Can we have
your job?
Good
to see you.
Yeah,
I just gave you your license plate number.
Email to me to have Jane.
His daughter
and my daughter went to high school together,
one of his friends
also. Very sad. Okay, are we set to go? I remind members we're still on the record, so careful what you're saying near your microphone. Gentlemen, we're very happy to have you here. It's a privilege. It's 12:15. We know that Commissioner Masters has a 1:30 with the governor. Chair Milton has a 2 p.m. meeting scheduled for House Energy. Gentlemen, if you'll introduce yourselves for the record to take us through the PowerPoint, we're very happy to have you here, and I hope you don't mind us interrupting you for questions along the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Hans Brinke. I'm a captain with the Alaska State Troopers.
Pull the microphone towards you so you can. There you go.
Is that better?
Much better,
okay.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm Captain Brinke with the Alaska State Troopers. I'm the commander of the new Bureau of Highway Patrol, and I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today.
Welcome. We're delighted to have you.
Good afternoon. My name is Barry Wilson. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers, Division Operations, currently oversees Search and Rescue and Public Information Office. And I've been given the honor of presenting for the colonel. I won't be nearly as eloquent, but I will try to get across his intentions and his thoughts. Since the last two or three years, we've had several empty positions that we have been working diligently to fill, and the colonel has done an excellent effort on filling those positions and recruiting for them. But because of those and the calls for services, we've had a lack of presence on the highways. Currently, we still have 35 positions that are in training, that are in the field and at the academy at this current time. We also noticed that statistics and reports were delayed due to the workload and the paper process that was being used. In that process, it's created almost a 2 to 3 year delay for us to get the statistical data to back up actions that we take on the roadway, both from DOT and from ourselves. We've worked hard to improve that. To make an improvement for those record keeping, we are in the process of implementing an electronic citation universally across the state for local departments and for the Department of Public Safety, and implementing the tracks and an RMS system, which allows for our electronic reporting of our reports and of our collision reports, therefore increasing the speed in which we can get that data back out. This is a much more efficient, better, and more timely statistics, which are more able for us to react correctly to situations as they arise, as they have this summer. Thank you.
Representative Dahlstrom, and then Johnson.
Thanks for being here, and thank you so much for your service. We at this table, I know you have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week jobs, and we appreciate you and the commitment your families make to public safety, too. When you talk about electronic citations, is that the cameras that have been discussed, or is that a system you have in the car so that you just punch a number in and they don't have to handwrite it?
That would be the system with the, through the chair. That would be a system to automatically, electronically issue a citation and print out a copy for the violator, which then automatically is coordinated with the court system and a database so that we can use that system. It's a separate issue than the photo or digital radar.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you have 35 positions in training, once those officers are on the street, will your staffing level be at 100%?
I think I'll let the captain answer that question.
Through the chair, right now I'm not 100% positive that all of our positions will be filled through just the 35 that are there. I believe through the next academy that we are recruiting for come this spring, I believe those ones will be filled. But I think that the commissioner could probably speak better to that than I could.
Mr. Chairman, I do know the answer. And what I want to be on the record of saying is you have the, and the commissioner can answer that, the legislature has provided the funding for you to be fully staffed. Is that correct? Is that an accurate statement?
Commissioner, your house is on fire. Better get up here.
Actually, the house is not on fire. This is Joe Masters again for the record. In response to the question, yes, the legislature did provide funding last year for 100% funding of all Alaska State Trooper positions statewide. And with the positions that are coming out of training, yes, 100% of the positions will be filled. There are also 15 additional positions that were added with federal funding in this fiscal year, actually starting October 1, because it's based on federal fiscal year grant money. And 10 of those, actually there's 13 positions, but 10 of those are troopers that would also be assigned, newly assigned to the Bureau of Highway Patrol as well. So as of October, we'd be able to start spending funds out of that grant award to the state to be able to augment the Bureau of Highway Patrol even more than it already is. And there's actually a slide that Captain Brinke will show regarding Bureau of Highway Patrol, how it's currently staffed and what the future staffing may look like.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, and my point of that is in our last presentation, funding was a huge issue. And in this presentation, I want we're sort of shift gears. This isn't a funding issue, because if you haven't gotten everything you need, we need to know about it, because I think you've got a lot of support for getting what you need. So I just want to make it clear that this, that we have provided the money, and you know, it's allocation of assets or whatever it works. It's training. It's getting people recruited. I know the jobs. It's hard to fill those positions, but it's unlike the transportation problem. This is not a funding problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your comments. It also sparked a point that I also wanted to make sure I made, and that is in regards to future funding as well. We're right now staffing up the Bureau of Highway Patrol with federal funds through the Alaska Highway Safety Office and also through HSIP funding, which is also DOT Highway Safety Improvement Plan or project. And as that federal funding wanes or decreases at the end of our plan for BHP, which is a five-year plan, we need to evaluate how BHP is doing, and if it's doing the job we think it's going to do, we need to plan for general funds to replace those federal funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Captain, sir. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and begin. So the Department of Public Safety, we're going to specifically talk about safety corridors, state troopers, and BHP as a whole. This right here, the first screen is talking about the statewide statistics, and you've seen these through Ron Martindale already, that we've had 40 fatalities that have come across the state as a whole. This includes AST, APD, and any other department across the state. 38 crashes that are here. The statistics that are in this next slide, I've broken them out so you can see them a little bit better as we go through. These statistics are specifically the Alaska State Trooper fatality numbers that we have. The first one is talking about 2007 through 2009, the fatal lives lost. We're at 23 so far for 2009, and it's state trooper-wide. Motor vehicle traffic crashes, we're at 22 crashes. And the difference between the crashes and the fatal, it's obvious. We may have one crash, but there may be multiple fatalities that are involved in this. Impaired driving-related motor vehicle fatalities, we're at 6 for the year. This is troopers only. The major impaired driving-related fatal motor vehicle traffic crashes that are involving impaired driving, we're at 6. Percentage of impaired driving-related motor vehicle traffic fatalities, we're at 27.3% of impaired driving-related. That's either alcohol or drug impaired. Percentage of driving-related fatal motor vehicles, that's at 28.6%. That is also the alcohol and drug involved. We're going to specifically talk about Girdwood Post. And in years past, from 1977 on to current, we started out with only one trooper assigned to the Girdwood area addressing all the fatal collisions and major injuries. We started out in 1977 with four, and we've had a wide variety. It's gone down during that first several years up to 1991. Going into 1992, we actually increased the number of troopers to two, and in 96 we increased it to three, and in 97 we increased to four troopers on that highway. But we've also seen from information provided by Mr. Martindale is that we have the population increases. We have the average daily travel has increased throughout the years. We are still having the fatalities and major injuries on that highway. In 2009 alone, in the Seward area, mile 111, 88, 76, 74, and again in mile 111, three of these have occurred in the traffic safety corridor specifically, and these are fatal collisions that we're all here talking about today. Two of them have been outside of them. Those are the ones at 76 Mile of Seward and 74 Mile of Seward. What we've been trying to do to address this is back in 2007, the Department of Transportation invited several groups to come together and talk about the creation of the Strategic Highway Safety Plan. AST, DPS was asked to come on board, and we did participate. I was the elected individual who was honored enough to do that. And this began a very unique thing for us, communication, collaboration. We didn't have real good communications with DOT coming in and talking about specific data, how we're going to share that data with each other, and how I can improve as far as enforcement, getting that data. We can do the individual collision investigations. We can provide the data, but we haven't had the ability to actually analyze what is there. That's the unique thing about having Ron Martindale on board with DOT is all of our statistics are going through him. It actually comes back to me, and we're using those to actually come up with enforcement plans.
Thank you. And, Captain, on that point, can I take you back to the slide with the 2009 at the header, please? These are the really the large catalyst for what brought us here. These are these sensational fatalities that have happened in the Seward Highway corridor. And I was reading the description of these five accidents. Appear four of them were head-on collisions where a driver crossed the center line, and one of them was ejected off the back of a motorcycle. So there are four that are similar to some of the material that we covered with the DOT. I just want to make sure I'm reading these correctly. Is that kind of the consensus of the table? Representative Dugan, is that what it looks like to you?
Mm-hmm.
And so can you just pause right there with the Seward Highway, because that's really a little bit what drove us, you know, to this hearing today, you know, we're recognizing all of the hot spots across the state. Can you talk about nature of accidents? So these don't indicate whether there was alcohol involved in these, but one is falling asleep, swerve, and how much of our situation on the Seward Highway goes back to what Mr. Martindale talked about with it being a rural highway corridor, it's a two-lane highway, and many of the fatalities that we had this year were head-on collisions where a driver crossed the center line and struck a vehicle coming the other direction. Can you talk about that a little bit before we proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. A lot of the incidences we're coming across is it's a very small funnel that we're going from a major area of Anchorage going down the Kenai Peninsula, especially in the summertime. We've got a lot of recreational users. Going through a funnel, it's just going to cause a backlog of vehicles trying to get from one location to the next. Impatient drivers, and it goes back to, like Commissioner Masters indicated, driver behavior. Having these issues come across, everybody wants to get where they want to go quickly. But unfortunately, with overcapacity on these roadways, you can't get there in a timely fashion or in a fashion where someone wants to get there as quickly as they would like to. So this is a major issue that we're coming across. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the delay of vehicles here in a little bit, too. But we're always talking about, you know, what are the laws specifically talking about? If you got five vehicles or more behind you, do you need to pull off? Is it the delay of these vehicles or the RVs, the recreational users coming down that's causing this problem? But part of this is the violators themselves. They don't want to slow down, and they want to get to where they want to go in a quicker manner. So it is an issue that is out there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. If you take the total number of fatalities in a year, what percentage of those happen on state roads, essentially where you have jurisdiction?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, if I can go backwards, I can show you one of the screens that actually talks about in the previous year.
You wouldn't mind. I just want to make sure I saw what I thought I saw.
These are the motor vehicle fatalities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the motor vehicle crashes that we have. In 2007, we had 46. 2008, we had 40. And so far in 2009, and these are state trooper only, and these are on the roadways that we're responsible for, and meaning Fairbanks outside of the jurisdiction of the Fairbanks Police Department, and the Matsu Valley outside of the jurisdictions of the Wasilla Police Department, the Palmer Police Department, outside the city limits of Anchorage. So these are the areas that are just we're responsible for.
So it'd be, Mr. Chairman, what would that be? Roughly half the fatalities are in state trooper territory and the other half are elsewhere? Is that what I'm...
We're looking statewide right now. We're having 38 collisions statewide. So I'm going to... make sure I get my math correct. Out of 48 in 2009 alone, 22 are ours, so 50% is getting pretty close to it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Representative John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines, there are a lot of state roads inside the city limits. And for example, the accident that happened on Fireweed, which was handled by, I think, city police, but it's a state road. Would those statistics be a state statistic? So are they in there even though the troopers didn't handle it? Are they broken out? Are you dealing strictly with the DOT, or do you break your own out after they give you yours? So I guess would that be considered a fatality that the municipality handled, even though it was a state road? And it's outside of, so it's a two-part question. So where would that number be?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, those particular crashes are handled by the Anchorage Police Department. And yes, we do have jurisdiction within the city limits of Anchorage. We don't generally run traffic patrols in there, but it's not saying that we haven't made attempts in the past to do multi-jurisdictional enforcement efforts alongside the city of Anchorage in addressing those. But those statistics are predominantly theirs. We do look at the statistics in conjunction with APD, see whether we can assist each other. Predominantly the information that we work off is what we're going to be enforcing in our jurisdiction alone.
So Mr. Chairman, if I might, so the Department of Transportation, once you get the Department of Transportation numbers that happen on a state road, you break that out saying this was not in our jurisdiction, so you back that out of the numbers. So this is basically only outside the city limits of Anchorage, Fairbanks, Wasilla, Kenai, those areas that you kind of have agreements with. Is that accurate? So those are segregated numbers?
Yes, sir.
Representative Johansson.
If I could. This highway, the Seward Highway, is actually in the municipality of Anchorage. So does the municipality take any responsibility for that? Do they provide any support on that highway, or is that strictly a state trooper? And then break that down. If that's the case, what about Johns Road in my district, which is a state road? Where was it delineated that a state road, I mean, where's the cutoff, or is there a cutoff? I mean, I never see, I see municipal police out on the, between here and Eagle River, but I also see troopers. I don't see any municipality police out on the Seward Highway. So how is that delineated? How's that sharing of duties done? Help me understand where the state roads inside the municipality and the state roads, well, not within, but more the proper bowl area, I guess, and outside. Is there any official agreement, or is it just an understanding? Can you tell me how that works?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Johnson, you're absolutely correct. They do have jurisdiction to go all the way down to Portage within the municipality. It's very similar to Hillside of years past. The troopers were responsible for taking care of Hillside. We did pull out, and the reason why the troopers were opting to provide services on Hillside is because the citizens of that particular area were not paying for law enforcement services. We're required to provide law enforcement services to those areas that aren't paying for them in other areas, which is the case here on the Seward Highway going down to Girdwood and Portage. We're taking care of it because those services aren't being paid for individually through the Anchorage Police Department.
Work on it.
Probably not, but we'll move on. Representative Johansson and then Grunberg, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask basically the same question, but now that I've heard the answer, so basically the people down in that neck of the woods decide that they don't want to pay for the municipality to cover, so therefore it becomes the state's problem or responsibility.
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, that is my understanding, that they have the ability to pay for the services down there, and that it is substantial cost for them to come down, and it is our responsibility for the areas that aren't being provided services.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
If my city, which sits inside of a borough, decided we didn't want to pay for our police, you guys would take over for us? And we wouldn't have to pay any taxes, and the state would pay for it, much like this portion of the municipality of Anchorage that's chosen to do that?
Through the chair, I'm not sure how to answer that. I think that's probably
job,
a better thing to leave to the commissioner at this point.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Representative Grunberg.
Unless I'm mistaken, the hillside now pays for its police. So that problem no longer exists, at least in Anchorage. That was directed to Representative Johansson. But I'd like you to go back to the slide you just had a minute ago, please, on the fatality.
I'm sorry. Are you looking for just Alaska State Troopers statistics
or
statewide?
Yeah, the ones with the mutt. It was a vertical slide. It wasn't that. Yeah. Okay. It seemed to, well, there was a little different one, but the figure is basically the same. In both the slides, the most dramatic drop was in the month of June, and this one goes from 9 to 3 to 1 over 3 years. And in the other one, well, this one too slightly, goes from actually 13 to 10 to 6 in July. In the other slide too, those 2 months stand out over time as a very dramatic drop. Why? For June and July only.
Well, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it's the different types of the year or different times of the year. We've got a lot of recreational users going down to the Kenai Peninsula, and as has been indicated before, a lot of the motor vehicle collisions are happening in the South Central areas, and that's going from the Anchorage area down to the Kenai Peninsula for the recreational use.
Let me make sure you understand the question. Same month, apparently same location, but in 2007, for the month of June on this slide, there were 9 fatalities. The next year, there were 1/3 of that, only 3. This year, so far, well, we've passed June and July, there's 1/3 again. So each year, they were cut in thirds. For July, it's not quite as dramatic. It went down from 13 to 10 to 6. So over a 3-year period, it was cut in half. Why? What have you done differently, or is that total coincidence?
Well,
what are you doing better now?
Well, I would like to say that what we're doing better now is we've got the Bureau of Highway Patrol that's actually in existence, and we started that officially December of 2008. We've made significant efforts to go down to the Seward Highway. We have used the data that was presented to us showing where we're having the major collisions, fatalities, major injuries across the state, and South Central is the area that we needed to be. We started going down there early in May for Memorial weekend, and we've continued a presence down on the South Central area, Seward Highway specifically. And in the last month, significant amounts of our redeployment of our BHP members from Fairbanks, Palmer, and then the new team that we have in Soldotna has been showing a lot of enforcement effort right there in that particular area.
And if I may follow up, so those changes apparently only occurred in those 2 months. I mean, why, if you're doing that, are you only doing it in those 2 months? Otherwise, if you're doing it generally, why doesn't it drop across the board for March and February and every other time? I don't need it. Maybe you need to think more about that. But it seems that those are very dramatic figures, and I don't see them for any other month.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm not sure that I can really answer your question. We have been out working since December, but we have a small group of troopers that are out here currently. As we're growing, we're hoping to hit more of the areas and have a bigger effect statewide. Right now, June and July, we've been doing a lot of efforts getting there. But as far as the Bureau itself, we've had to go through training exercises. We've had to come in with motor vehicle collision investigative training, commercial vehicle training. So there are significant things that when you're bringing a new unit together is you have to have the infrastructure built up. Where are we going to have the administrative support? Are we training our people to go out and properly take care of these? Once we got everybody trained, we're starting to focus more of our efforts down on the Seward Highway because we know that that's the issue. But we do have to get to those points where we are the expert to take care of those situations.
Thank you. Representative Dugan has a question, and then Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To go back to your 2009 slide, where I guess is where we were at, one of the things that's got people in my district most riled up about this is that in every case, the person or people who were killed were not actually the instigators of the accident. And I'm curious whether this is an anomaly, if it's typical. What is it that we're looking here, just judging, you know, sort of the victims and the perpetrators in this case?
Through the chair, Representative Dewey, I don't have a statistic that's going to be able to tell you that, but just anecdotally, thinking about it, more often than not, it's the victim of the other vehicle that dies. Let's say it's an impaired driver. More often than not, it's the impaired driver that's not dying. In just about every one of these situations, it was the potentially. I can't specifically speak to these particular cases because they're still ongoing cases. So if I had to say a similar situation, an at-fault driver, more often than not, is not the one that is dying.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Captain, you're doing a masterful job.
Thank you.
So, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if, to go back to Representative Grunberg's question, if there is a correlation between volume of traffic, do we have a fatality per mile driven statistic that can be pulled out of that? Are we talking about a terrible increase in traffic, and so the number is going to go up, but the percentage is not, maybe not an increase? Is there a correlation that the department could pull together that accident per mile or anything like that, that we could break it into a more usable or understandable method? Because if the traffic went up 20% and if fatalities went up 50%, then we've got a problem. But if traffic went up 50%, we only went up 10, then, I mean, we have a problem anytime someone dies, and I don't want to be callous. But is there a way we can break those statistics out?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Johnson, absolutely. I think we can bring that out. Which is data that's already been provided to me by DOT. We can make some of that available to you. I can talk with Ron Martindale and make sure that we're identifying those. That's how I'm able to come up with my enforcement programs and identifying times of day, time or what days of the week are the best, what months are the best for us to be out, where we're going to have the most effect.
If I could have follow-up.
Follow-up?
When you're looking at the large increase in numbers from, you know, 3 to 10 or like that, can you tell, is that something that you can put your finger on, that the traffic increased 70% in those numbers where there was those large jumps? I mean, I understand that you want to take credit, and I want you to have credit if that's what's happening. We're always talking about larger numbers of traffic, et cetera, smaller traffic, fish runs. You know, there's all kinds of reasons that you get fewer cars on the highway during that month when they're going north instead of south.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I would like to say that I'm taking credit for it, but a lot of my information that comes as far as data does come from DOT. We provide it to them. They analyze it for us. And definitely the vehicle miles traveled is very important to our enforcement efforts, and it will show. If you've got a larger amount of traffic going down in a small area, you're going to have more collisions, and that's just statistically shown that's in there. And going along with Ron Martindale, I think we can be able to provide you with that kind of information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Remember? Yeah. If we can go back to the slide that looks like this. There we go. Well, people would have to look at their packet to see this slide. You can't really see it on that. But I'd just like to call your attention to two things. There are a total of six graphs on here. The first, the second, and then the bottom two under that. In each of those cases, we see dramatic drops over the years, 2007 down, 2008 down, 2009. On the other hand, if you look from between June and July in each of those years, the number of accidents dramatically increases. So we have them dramatically decreasing in the same month over the years, and in each year dramatically increasing between June and July. And as you're analyzing this data, if you could take a look and try to find an explanation, maybe it's some car count or whatever, but I'd be interested in knowing what's going on. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're welcome. Captain, you'll continue with the presentation. I'm on drafted 2007 adopted September 2007. It's the flight I'm on. Is that where the group is?
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Where the group is the challenge in itself.
Yeah. Captain, the floor is yours.
Continuing on with the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, it was, like I was saying, it was a unique opportunity for me to be able to go through and work with several of the engineers, and this was just the beginning of our relationship, and it kind of progressed into the Traffic Safety Corridor Review Committees. Sitting in a car with a group of engineers kind of had me a little intimidated for a while, but as soon as I figured out that they were actually humans and they talked, you know, normal, it made for a really good relationship.
Did you test their DNA to determine that? Or?
No, sir.
Sorry.
I did watch the speedometer quite a bit. And I know that the commissioner and Ron Martindale have also talked about the three E's, the engineering, the enforcement, and the education aspect. In the engineering part of it, that is Department of Transportation. But during the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, I did step up, and I wanted to learn a little bit more. So I joined in with the co-chair for the engineering portion of the Strategic Highway Safety Plan so that I can put my aspect of what law enforcement is into that, and at the same time listen to what they had to say and kind of combine those efforts into one. The enforcement efforts are definitely Department of Public Safety and local law enforcement. The education part of it is through DOT, through the Highway Safety Office, and through Department of Public Safety. We had indicated in December 1 of 2008, we've been trying to get the Bureau of Highway Patrol on the road and start taking care of some more enforcement efforts that were out there. Commissioner Masters came on board, said make it happen, and we did. So starting in December 1, we did start. Our first goal was providing a statewide traffic law enforcement team, safeguarding the well-being of everyone. And I specifically put that in there. We're not talking about just well-being of Alaskans on the road. We're talking about well-being of all Alaskans that are affected by what happens on the road. If I want to get milk from Anchorage down to Kenai and the roads are closed down because of major collision or someone wants to go fishing, that's affecting other people's well-being, not just what's going on the road with the people and as far as collisions and deaths. We're trying to do this through a proactive leadership, a sustained high visibility enforcement, dedicated enforcement. And this particular team is dedicated to traffic law enforcement, not necessarily going and taking calls of service, which is a dramatic amount of our time as far as public safety, taking care of sexual assaults, domestic violences. But this group here stays on the highway to protect the roads. Education and technologies. Lieutenant Wilson had talked about some of the technologies they're working on, the RMS systems, the electronic data storage systems, the electronic citations, making our flow of data faster so that we can get the information back and make appropriate decisions on where we're going to be that day. Currently, what we have for the Bureau of Highway Patrol is myself, and currently I'm taking care of two jobs. I work for the colonel in the director's office, and I'm also working as the commander for the Bureau of Highway Patrol. And I have a lieutenant assigned as a deputy commander. He's also doing double duty. He's been our recruiting lieutenant for the last couple of years, and he's also working with the Bureau. But we currently have three teams, sergeants and Palmer with three troopers, and you'll see that I have a Palmer PD and a Wasilla PD listed on there. We have entered into agreements with our local law enforcement agencies, and they've come on board through federal funds to also participate in this statewide. And they're not just enforcing the laws right there in their own territories. They're going statewide. They're with us. And the thought of that is they participate in using Alaska as a whole, so they're stepping up and saying we need to also protect Alaska as a whole. So they go wherever the troopers are going at the same time. We have a sergeant in Fairbanks with two troopers currently, a sergeant in Soldotna with three trooper positions and a Kenai officer also down there. And you'll see to the right we have a criminal justice tech, and that's our felony DUI forfeiture clerk that we take care of. They do all the paperwork. Anytime someone gets caught for a felony and they have a vehicle, we forfeit those vehicles. Our education program goes with our visual information specialist, and he's also assigned to the Bureau. Our current grant applications that we have in, and the Bureau is paid through federal funds through the Alaska Highway Safety Office. 2009 to 2010, what we're doing is we're adding six more positions. They're indicated in the dark blue. We've got the captain that's actually coming on board full-time, which is myself, taking care of the Bureau of Highway Patrol. We've got two troopers that we're stationing in Palmer building that team because most of our collisions are happening in South Central. Fairbanks, we're adding a trooper, and then we're also going through a letter of agreement to bring the Fairbanks Police Department on board with us also. The Soldotna team, we're adding two more troopers, and we made the decision that we're going to directly assign those troopers to the Girdwood Post because we have identified the need for them to be right there on the Seward Highway. Our anticipated plans for next year is we're going to continue asking for additional personnel. The more people we have on the roads, the better we're going to have as far as enforcement. We're going to be more effective, more efficient. We're going to add two more positions into the Palmer area along with a clerk. We're looking at adding one more trooper to Fairbanks and also one more trooper to Soldotna.
Captain, just on this point, as I see you flesh out this team across the state, and I applaud the initiative, what will this group not be doing? For instance, what do you not respond to other than, for backup? Is it exclusively highway patrol? Is that the nature? I was just rereading the mission statement for the group. So are these specifically highway-oriented positions so you don't respond to DD calls or to burglaries or snow machine theft in Cantwell or in more remote places? What distinguishes the Bureau of Highway Patrol from the troopers that otherwise are assigned to those corridors that are, full-service troopers that wouldn't, be designated with the Bureau of Highway Patrol?
Mr. Chairman, these particular troopers are funded through federal funds, so we're primarily responsible for doing traffic law enforcement. But that is not necessarily what we're going to do all the time. Emergency services to the public and any type of emergency situation is going to come up first. So if someone is having a burglar go through their house, there are no other troopers or law enforcement officers available, we will go and take care of those situations. So life is very important to us, whether it's on the highway or whether it's off the highway. But our primary focus is the highway. There's a lot of calls of service that may be the emergency, but there are also other calls of service, dogs barking, noise complaints, things like that, that the patrol troopers are assigned to do that. So we're not generally going to take our guys from the Bureau of Highway Patrol off the road to go take care of those type of calls. So emergencies are definitely a number one priority. Secondary, we're going to be on the highway. We're not going to be called off. And we specifically had talked about that. It's going to be sustained enforcement, but it's a dedicated enforcement because if we got into that situation where we're always being called off, then what we're doing is we're just providing more troopers for detachment.
Understood. And certainly we're here because of concerns about the highway, but the question that I want to get at, we have a new chief executive for the state. I'm listening to the governor who talks about the economy and he talks about family. And certainly those of us that serve on the Judiciary Committee are well aware of, domestic violence and problems, in households. So if we were to lay this org chart side by side with an org chart for the Alaska State Trooper various detachments, would we see positions come out of the other org chart where troopers are able to respond to the issues that we're accustomed to troopers being available to respond to? Would we see a smaller pool of those troopers available? That there has been a reallocation of human resources to the Bureau of Highway Patrol? Because I see as we go through these slides where we highlight the new positions that are added going forward, and you said those are from the federal highway funds, but I look at the other trooper assignments in the Palmer area, in the Fairbanks area, in the Soldotna and Kenai area. Are those troopers who were responding to citizens that were in distress and are now being reallocated to traffic, because you're seeing that as a higher priority, or are they all new positions? I mean, who's, if it's a zero sum, who's suffering? Who's losing trooper coverage? I'm not saying, stating it very well, but I think you see the nature of my question.
Mr. Chairman, these aren't positions that are specifically being taken away from detachment. We originally started several years ago with a couple DUI teams, one stationed out of Fairbanks and one stationed out of Palmer. And we've taken those positions that were dedicated for traffic and added these as the base of our group. All the rest of the positions that are coming out are new positions being funded federally. They're going to be filled with the new trainees that are coming out, so the academy, you know, that are the 35 that are here right now. But we're not taking these positions away from the existing detachments. It's an augmentation of the detachments by having these particular people out there. It gives the detachment troopers the ability to concentrate a little bit more on taking care of calls of service, whether you would usually be out doing traffic or taking care of motor vehicle collisions. That's our expertise. We're going to do that, freeing them up to take care of other calls of service in a more expeditious manner. And it does not relieve us from backing up any trooper. There was one point the guys were coming down to the Seward Highway to take care of patrols. As we were coming through the Talkeetna area, there was a gun call. Well, it happened to be that the BHP was in transit. We were able to be the first ones on scene. So there's a residual effect that you can get by having a mobile unit traveling across the state. We may be in the right area at the right time to take care of those calls. So it's an augmentation.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a concern. I think maybe the chairman does as well. Are we creating a totally new department? I mean, let's take, for example, the CJT, felony vehicles. Does the regular state troopers have that same position?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, this is a position that was assigned to the Division of Alaska State Troopers. It was specialized for DUI forfeitures. So just taking that individual under our supervision, watching what they're doing, because most of the DUIs are going to be handled by the BHP. So it's an administrative position that's there. We're not taking away from others.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But is there another one that exists in the state troopers doing the same thing?
No, sir, there's not.
So who does their CJT work if they have a problem? Because they'll also confiscate vehicles and issue tickets inside the city limits or wherever it is. And so who handles that? Is this person going to also cross over and handle the, I hate to say regular troopers, because, I mean, they're all, there's the existing department versus the highway patrol, for lack of a better term.
Right, through the chair. It's the same person that's going to handle both. This particular person also handles a couple of the municipalities that are throughout the state. It's not just the state troopers that she takes care of. It's a felony program statewide.
So this person is going to be on both organizational charts?
Currently, she's under the Division of Alaska State Troopers, but it's a subdivision of the Bureau of Highway Patrol.
If I might, as we go down the list here and I see County Clerk 3, tell me how that works. Is there another person in the division? Or have we created another department here, or is that a shared position as well with the regular troopers, for lack of a better term?
Through the chair, the administrative positions that are in here, the admin assistant, the admin clerk three, which are now been reclassified to admin office administrators, they are new positions that were authorized to us for this next year. So they are specifically assigned to this unit. They are doing our job, and at the same time, they will be augmenting the administrative staff in the task at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, and you don't have to come up, but I would suggest that if we're going to have clerks doing the same job for the same department, broken out traffic versus regular troopers, that we might look at efficiencies. And you don't have to answer it. I just see that as being, you know, do we need two, or could two do the job of three, or et cetera, et cetera. So just take a look at that before we start growing bureaucracy. Take a look at those positions. And once again, my pet peeve, Mr. Chairman.
Duly noted, Representative Johansson, and then Chair Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was mentioned by both groups that presence of officers on the road is a great deterrent. You see an officer out there. And it goes back to my questions about the municipality of Anchorage, and There's seven people in Anchorage here sitting at the table. None of them have said a word, so I might be jumping in the middle of some sort of a local battle. I don't know, but I'm ignorant, so I don't really care. So, but looking at this chart right here, I see that you have agreements with the Palmer Police Department, Wasilla Police Department, Fairbanks Police Department, Kenai Police Department. Why we're talking about that area south of here, which is within the municipality. Is there something stopping you guys from partnering with the Anchorage Police Department, since this is one of the biggest issues we're at this table for, is within the municipality of Anchorage? Why isn't Anchorage in here?
Through the chair, Representative Johansson, we had talked with the Anchorage Police Department. They do have a substantial traffic unit of their own. I'm not real sure as to why they have opted not to. I know that they're having their growing pains right at this particular moment at the same time. But it's not something we're not going to try and pursue again here in the future. But when we were first starting this out, they opted not to do this at this particular time.
Thank you very much. Interesting.
Madam Chair?
Thank you. My question is, I'm kind of looking into the future here, and I'm seeing dollar signs. And so is your intention to get this program rolling, and you've got grants for 5 years, is that correct?
Our proposal is for a five-year program, and that's what we're looking for, is at the end of the 5 years, make a determination on the value of the unit and how we're going to continue it at that point.
Follow-up. So as we go forward, is there any possibility that you can say, okay, we've added this many, that's this much money? We've added next page, we're going to add this much more, that's going to cost this, so that we have an idea as legislators how much it's going to cost, so that because we've got to be thinking ahead. If this comes off and you pull it off and it works wonderful and we see a huge drop in traffic fatalities, that we'll say, oh my goodness, this is something obviously that's got to continue, and so we know what we're talking about as far as money. Are you able to do that for us?
Representative Wilson, I believe we can provide with the information that you're looking for as the costs each year. It is definitely a substantial cost when we're creating new positions for training, vehicles, other equipment, and such like that. That's why we're deferring it right now with federal funds to check out the viability of this particular unit. But we can't provide you with those numbers.
Madam Chair?
Just one question. Is the funds coming from stimulus money, or is it coming out of somewhere else?
Representative Wilson, it's coming through the Alaska Highway Safety Office. It's NHTSA funding coming from federal funds. It's being funneled through the Department of Transportation Highway Safety Office. Part of those funds are also coming from the Highway Safety Improvement Program. Both of those different departments within DOT has both come up and said, we definitely see that the viability and the effectiveness of having a dedicated traffic team out there. So the funds are coming from two different pots funneled through the Highway Safety.
I guess what I just want to know, are those funds anywhere connected to one-time funds? I mean, I guess they are because they're a grant, but are they from the current stimulus money at all?
I don't believe that they are part of the stimulus money.
Okay.
I think we have an answer for that for you. Is that right, ma'am?
Through the record, this is Mary Soroki, Department of Transportation Public Facilities. Special Assistant to the Commissioner, no, the grants that are funding these programs are not ERA funds.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dugan, then Representative Hornberg, and, you know, I just want to remind members that we do have a part back here that's all about solutions.
Yeah.
I just want to remind you, the solutions are the last third of the presentation. So with that, Representative Dugan, and then Hornberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be happy to get the solutions once I understand the situation. I just want to make sure that I understand the situation as it exists now on the Seward Highway. And let's previous information and testimony, in fact, leads me to believe that essentially that once you get past Potter Marsh on the Seward Highway, that the traffic enforcement is being done by the Alaska State Troopers rather than the Anchorage Police Department. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that is correct. Going down to McHugh Creek is specifically where the Anchorage Police Department stops.
Okay, so from McHugh Creek on, it's troopers. It's and the enforcement there comes from the where is the trooper station or troopers stationed who do that work?
Through the chair, we have troopers that are assigned to the Girdwood Post.
Okay,
and they are there for calls of service, which is the full menu department or post. So they do a lot of traffic enforcement at the same time. But with the redeployment, with the amount of troopers that we have currently within the BHP, we have to reassign some of them from one location to go down and hit the areas. That's why we're a mobile unit, to tackle the specific spots that we've identified that we need to be at. So a lot of our Palmer guys are going down and being assigned to the Seward Highway on a regular basis.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, but the expansion here that's listed on this slide assumes that there are going to be permanent highway patrol personnel assigned in Girdwood for the Seward Highway. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
And they answer to, sorry, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I understand this before I put my foot in it. And they answer administratively to the Soldotna office. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
And why is it that there's no closer administrative support than Soldotna? Why isn't there an office in Anchorage if, in fact, you're patrolling a couple hundred miles of road, at least half of which is a heck of a lot closer to Girdwood than it is Soldotna?
Through the chair, we've chosen to do this because traditionally we have e-detachment, which is from the Girdwood area going all the way down to the peninsula. So we've tried to keep it in kind of centralized attachments. That's their region they're going to be responsible for. So as we grow a little bit more, we don't have to take some of the resources from Fairbanks and from Palmer to take care of one particular area. We can actually start taking care of our regions, and each region then will get the more bang for their buck as we're going along. So the sergeant that is assigned down there is traditional. It's really close to what we do with our drug units, and I was in the drug unit for an awful long time, so we kind of gear it the same way. The Soldotna guys take care of, you know, what's going on the Kenai Peninsula. So the Girdwood is the Kenai. Same thing with Palmer and same thing with Fairbanks. We have offshoot areas within those detachments in those regions. So the administrative support is there, and we're not taken away from the fact that Girdwood Post itself does have administrative support in that particular office also.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. To follow up first on Representative Dugan, do you folks also provide the general police protection services in Girdwood, or are there also municipal police officers there?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we take care of Girdwood. There are no municipal officers assigned to take care of those calls of service.
Secondly, to follow up on Representative Wilson's questions, these additional positions you've testified are all federally funded, right?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
How much assurance do you have that the federal funding will continue, and for how long?
Through the chair, I'm not 100% positive how long they're going to be here and to what level they're going to be at. Each year we have to wait until the funds come out, and the funds are distributed through the Highway Safety Office.
So if they don't fund this next year, what happens?
Through the chair, then we're going to have to make a decision as to whether we're going to try and take these positions, put them back into the general population, whether we're going to general fund them. I'm not positive at this particular point on what the plans are for them.
Thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. To follow up on that point, do the federal funds cover all the costs of the mobile unit, the infrastructure, the training, the equipment?
Through the chair, we are taking care of all of the costs that are in there through the federal funds. The guys coming on board, their salaries, personal services, all of our equipment items, commodities, communications, training, travel, it's all taken care of through the federal funds.
Thank you, Captain. If you'll continue, please.
Continuing past the federal fiscal year where we're increasing, we're anticipating in 2011, and I've indicated 2011-2012 because the federal fiscal year is in October. So we're anticipating asking for additional troopers to be more effective and more efficient on the highways. So we're looking at putting an additional trooper on the Palmer team, two additional into Fairbanks, and two additional into Soldotna.
Very good.
Chairman, before we go too far, we talked
we
about...
We haven't gone too far.
Yeah, don't worry. We might. Does the federal grants also cover the retirement thing into the retirement system, or is that general fund state money that's going in there?
Through the chair, that's taking care of their personal services package, the entire package that comes through.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No.
I'd indicated the strategic highway safety plan came up with several areas that we needed to address statewide. And there were multiple areas, engineering, behavior-wise, and then the interest groups, bicyclists. We had to pick what we were going to do as far as the Bureau of Highway Patrol. One of the areas that we have chosen was the impaired driving. About 24.9% of the collisions that were coming across, major injuries and the fatals, were alcohol or drug involved. And these are statistics going from 1997 to 2006. The next one, with the same statistics, we're showing 43.5% of aggressive driving. And that is a big cause of a lot of fatalities. It is not uncommon that if you have a drug or alcohol impaired driver going down the road, that he's not going to be driving aggressively and speeding at the same time. So there is an overlap on some of these issues that are here. So we've chosen impaired driving as a main focus. We've chosen aggressive driving and speeding as a main focus.
Crossing the center line would be considered aggressive driving?
Yes, sir.
Passing?
No. I would consider that to be an aggressive driver in combination with other factors. If you're speeding, passing in a no-passing zone, or speeding and passing where you shouldn't be passing because you have oncoming traffic, that is an aggressive maneuver. One of the leading causes for the death of teens is motor vehicle collisions. In the state of Alaska right now, anywhere from 24% to 33% from 2001 to 2007, 24% to 33% of the fatalities and major injuries involve drivers between the age of 16 and 20. Seatbelts has also been a major concern of ours. Definitely seatbelts save lives. And currently in 2009, we've had 40 fatalities, and out of the 40 fatalities, we have 5 unbelted drivers or unbelted passengers. And we've increased our seatbelt usage from 2003 from 78.9% to last year, I believe when I made this slide, I think 94.9% for last year is a typo on my part, but it was a really good goal that I'd like to put in there for years to come. But I believe that we're at 84.9, if I'm correct, in 2008. And seatbelts is definitely an important aspect of what we're doing. Our federal funds that come through are specific funds also, occupant protection, impaired driving, traffic records. So we do have to identify those things that the funds have to be used for. So in conjunction with the Strategic Highway Safety Plan, the Bureau has chosen impaired driving, aggressive driving and speeding, occupant protection, and then the education of the youth on the roadways. The citations, and this is specifically to the Alaska State Troopers, the citations from December of 2008 to present. Citations that have been written by the troopers statewide, 19,377 citations. The Bureau itself, since the inception in December, we've written just under 6,000 citations. The Seward Highway citation that we've written, and that's 1,874. The Seward Highway Safety Corridors, and these are specific Alaska State Trooper as a whole, we've written 1,256 tickets. And in the Bureau of Highway Patrol, specifically in the safety corridor over the summer, we've written 526 citations. The statewide traffic team spent 1,242 hours specifically assigned to the Seward Highway from December to present, and we have issued, as a whole, approximately 798 tickets. Instead of reading each one of the items that are here, trying to get moving along a little bit further, what's listed in the next couple of slides is specifically what our BHP team members have done, when they've come down to the Seward Highway, what their statistics are, and how many hours they've spent. We've talked about education. Enforcement and education is what the Alaska State Troopers do. It's one of the three E's. What we have been doing, one of our education aspects is we've been trying to get together with the youth. One specific one is the Alaska Military Youth Academy. We've been asked to come in, educate the youth that are there on traffic safety, DUI enforcement, what they should be looking for and what they should be doing, trying to promote good judgment on the roadway. We do have programs where we go and we talk to the military. Each winter they have new personnel that come in into the facilities. They want to know how to drive on Alaska roads. We also have been asked by private companies to come in, talk with their people on traffic safety issues, not just during their work hours, but during their off hours. And what we suggest to them, they may take home to their families. Part of our education program, and we've discussed this before, is media. We've had 15 impaired driving, occupant protection, and Roadwise Alaska ads that we've put on this year alone through federal funds. And these are the campaigns that you see on TV, the click it or ticket campaigns, the impaired driving.
Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back and noticing your slide earlier where you said a high percentage of these accidents involve drivers between 16 and 20, are you also in the public high schools? I know that Representative Dahlstrom earlier was talking about this every 15 minutes program, but are you doing a lot of outreach? That would seem sort of an obvious place if a lot of the drivers are 16 to 20.
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, as far as specific traffic safety, no. We are going in and we're dealing with DARE programs, so we are talking with the students there, but we haven't gone specifically into the schools. And Commissioner Masters has commented earlier that he is starting to become involved in the every 15 minutes, and I anticipate that I will become more and more involved in that also.
Thank you. President Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How effective is our enhanced driver's license laws been, and could we tune those up a little bit? I know we're kind of in the middle in terms of what some states do, so we just kind of started that. Can you address the enhanced driver's license?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't have specific statistics that are telling whether the programs are effective or not because of that. I can do some research and let you know what I can come up with, but I don't have specific information that's saying that it's productive, but I'm not saying that it's not being productive. I know that we do need to educate our youth better. I'd like to see for them to have that education earlier on so they can develop really good driving skills, develop judgment, and make proper behavioral choices when they're on the roadway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
I'm not sure I understood one thing you said. With respect to the military briefings and the briefings for the private employees, do you at the same time invite the spouses to come?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have not, to my knowledge, invited the spouses to come to any of the programs that we've done. Most of the ones with the military, we do go on the military establishments and talk with the specific groups. I am not aware of any of the programs that we've offered.
Is there any reason you would be unable to do that?
I don't see a reason why we couldn't.
Would you be willing to do that?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Grunberg, you know being a retired military, but you may have forgotten because you haven't lived on a base for a long time, they or any other group are not welcome to come to the group and or the a base and present anything unless they are invited. So
sure.
We need to go down another avenue to
But they could certainly
if they're invited.
Offer that, yes, certainly, of course.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. I've gone back to the first data about the teenagers, and it's obvious that we have give or take a few percentage points, probably a fourth of the accidents are involved with teenagers. Is that, am I extrapolating the data correctly?
Yes, Representative Wilson. The data showing over the several years from 2001 and on, it was ranging from 33, and it's getting better. Right around 27% is an average that we're looking at that we have youth that are involved with collisions.
Is there a difference in were they fatalities or were they just a lot of little accidents? Or I guess what I'm getting at is how important is it, and do we need to be really zeroing in on that? If a fourth of them are in schools, maybe we should be zeroing in at schools. I'm just asking.
Representative Wilson, I agree that we do need to start educating better at the schools before they even get on the road and when they are on the road. These specific statistics are talking about the fatal and the major injuries. There are a lot of slower-moving collisions that are occurring with the youths, so that's why the percentage is a little bit lower. But as far as the collisions as a whole, damage, accident, only, those are quite a bit higher than the 24 to 27%.
Then I guess what I'm saying is, or what I'm thinking, is that maybe your Bureau of Highway Patrolmen need to be thinking about going into the schools and doing some teaching or something. So, I mean, if it's going to be something that we're adding extra, that might be an area that we could cut down on if the kids saw. I saw an advertisement. I can't remember where I saw it. I think it was on a news station, but it was Good Morning America, I think it was. And they were showing what happened when these teenagers were in the car, and they were a bunch of them were talking, and one was talking on the phone and everything. And then it showed what happened during the accident, and everybody was getting knocked around, and people were dying, and all this. And there's a website you could go to and see this. And, I mean, even if kids saw something like that, it might make them think because it was very graphic. And but if a high percentage of our accidents are with teenagers, then we really need to look at that and direct some of our campaign educational literature toward them.
Absolutely, Representative Wilson. I agree. We do need to get into schools and educate. And as the unit does grow and gives us the opportunity to continue our enforcement, and take some of our resources and get into the schools and start educating at the same time.
Okay. Is there one year specifically that you're planning on moving on into the schools then or something?
I'd like to start on this next year. If we get our positions filled, we're able to accomplish more. The larger amount of people that you have, you can accomplish more tasks. With the smaller amount, we're only able to try and identify the areas that we need to be right now, which is our redeployment on the Seward Highway, which takes dramatic resources from the Palmer area to come down and take care of it. But as we grow, I do anticipate us going in, whether it's during this next year, we're going to try and increase that, and I do anticipate on increasing that throughout the next several years.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We want to proceed through the rest of this presentation. We have about five more minutes with Commissioner Masters, however, before he has an appointment. Are there any members that have any specific questions or comments that they want to direct to Commissioner Masters while we have him in the room? And I want to thank you, Commissioner Master, for being so available to us for the meeting, the pizza party that Representative Millett threw, and then for taking the time to organize a very thorough presentation with very capable officers. Are there any questions for Commissioner Master specifically before he leaves us? Representative Groomberg?
Just one, and this is something that's been addressed a bit before, but by my count, you're looking at over several years basically doubling the size of the BHP. You have 16 troopers now. I'm not talking about support staff. And you're going to add another 15. And this is totally dependent upon federal funding. I would hope that when this is discussed with the legislature as it goes on, that you have an alternative plan B, what you're going to do if all or part of the federal funding falls away. Otherwise, you're going to basically have a program that's going to have to be cut in half.
Through the chair, yes, when we're dealing with trying to add positions and those positions are federally funded,
always have to balance and look at how we take those positions on. You know, certainly before we added or even asked to add the positions last year, for example, of which we're looking at 10 more positions beyond the 10 that have already been authorized during the last session. We certainly look for commitments from our funding sources and our commitments from DOT to continue to, or at least intend to continue to provide that funding as much as they can. And in this case, this funding is a funding stream that has been around for a great number of years. It isn't a brand new funding that's around because of the Reinvestment Act or anything like that. We've been receiving federal funds from these sources for a great many years already. Some of it's already funded several positions that Captain Brink had already described. So we have a commitment that DOT is going to continue to work with us to bring these fatalities down and to work on highway safety, and we have to do our part to commit to doing that. The other aspect of it is, if we do lose funding, do we have a plan B, and how do we deal with that? Certainly, we may have to look at making a general fund request, and we also have the ability to look at what our current vacancies are and take those positions and fill those current vacancies with them, so we don't have to lose actual people and lay people off.
It is a
balance.
Thank you. Commissioner, because I'm mindful of the clock, we only have you for a couple more minutes, and in deference to Chair Wilson, can I direct members, please, to the last two slides of this presentation? We'll cover the rest as soon as we lose the commissioner. But Chair Wilson had asked specifically about photo radar, which is on here. The last two pages address short-term and long-term. A lot of the short-term items appear to be additional troopers, which is the subject that's been before us for the last 20 minutes. But if you could go over some of the short and long-term solutions that we're contemplating, including photo radar, which was a specific issue that was brought up by Representative Wilson.
Okay. The short-term, there's a number of things that we're doing currently right now that's affecting our crash rates. One is we're dedicating enforcement. We're coming up with enforcement programs. We're working with DOT to specifically find out where we need to be, when we need to be there, and using the data that they're able to analyze for us that we provide to them. So that working relationship is an extremely part of our short-term strategy. We're taking our current team members and we're placing them where they need to be. And those are short-term, non-sustainable efforts. We can only do that for so much of amount of time. You've already heard that BHP is intending on taking two of the positions they've already got allocated to put on the Seward Highway and dedicate that effort out of Girdwood. And we are looking at what I've described earlier is some different legislation that's currently in the books that we need to take a closer look at, particularly the delay of vehicles needs to be looked at, whether or not we want to do anything with headlight legislation, things like that. And then moving on to the longer term, a lot of our longer term is commitment to continue our highway safety efforts through GF funding or continued federal funding or a combination of both. And then the other part is the evaluation of this program to ensure that it's doing what it's designed to do and intended to do, and that the state's actually getting the return on investment that we're putting into it. More specific, I'll touch on aerial traffic enforcement and then get right into photo radar. The aerial traffic enforcement, we have been hit or miss over a number of years whether or not we do this. Generally, we don't do it because we don't have the ground forces, so to speak, to carry out stopping vehicles and writing the citations. We do have aircraft that we can utilize, and we have aircraft, I believe, in our current inventory that we could dedicate a portion of their service and time to this effort. But whether or not we want to go longer term with a dedicated aircraft is something we need to study. But more to the point on photo radar, photo radar is a tool that's used by a number of jurisdictions to combat speeding particularly, and in some cases also red light violators if they're red light cameras. This type of a program is not without a lot of controversy from a number of different sides and entities. There's no question about that. We're looking at photo radar to see whether it's an acceptable tool for DPS to implement in the state of Alaska. And as we get more and more into looking into photo radar, the more and more it is becoming apparent that it, this has got to be a well-thought-out program and one that we vet not only internally but also externally within the public and with the legislature on whether we're going to implement this type of a program. So far, nationwide, there you can do a Google search, and some of you probably already have, and you can see that there's a lot of touted studies on both sides. There are several studies, I believe, that show that photo radar is effective, and some of them are scientific. And there's a particular one that I've been looking into with the University of Calgary with Dr. Richard Tay that indicates that photo radar does affect the number of, and usage of photo radar does affect the number of crashes. And that's specifically what our aim would be, to reduce the number of crashes. If we do reduce the number of total crashes, we reduce the number of serious crashes. If we reduce the number of serious crashes, then that in turn reduces the number of fatal crashes. It all has an effect. Now, one thing that photo radar is, though, it's a specific tool to combat speeding. And that's what we have to understand as well. Speeding if you look at the data that DOT provided us, a speeding component is in about, I believe, 25% of the fatal crashes that we're currently experiencing. So if we do implement photo radar, then effectively we're going to be targeting that 24% for fatal crashes. But we also have to keep in mind, I think, that if we are enforcing speeding regulations on speeders, then we also get an effect, I think, on other driving behaviors as well. I'm not sure exactly how much carryover there is in that regard yet. There was a question earlier, I believe it was the chairman that asked maybe what the costs are with photo radar. And there is a huge variation around the nation. And currently it looks like there's about 23 states that authorize photo radar, from what I can tell so far, just in a preliminary look. But the variations of how those photo radar programs are run is extremely varied. Some of them are run by contract companies that will agree to set up all the equipment, and then they charge a per-ticket fee of around $30 or so, and then in other states it goes to the full extent where the states purchase the equipment and implement a program, and then they manage and run it themselves as well. So wide variance.
Thank you, Commissioner. So Representative Dugan, Holmes, Johansson, Chair Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't really have a question, Commissioner. I'd just encourage you, based on Anchorage's experience with photo radar, that if you were to decide to have a program like this go forward, that you find something different to name it.
Yeah.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the Commissioner started to go down the track I was going to go down, which was, you know, it seems like photo radar is aimed mostly at speeding, and as you said, speeding is only one component. You also have the distraction, you have the alcohol and drug use, you have all those different issues. So I guess I'm just trying to get my head around what's the best bang for the buck given what's causing the crashes.
As of today, my opinion is that the best bang for the buck is to have a trooper on the road writing a ticket and actually causing a fine to be paid and having person-to-person contact with a violator.
Representative Johansson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this chart, fatal major injury crashes by human circumstances, 44% aggressive driving, overwhelmingly the number one reason, three times higher than the second reason. Aggression is a behavior. I think there's a pretty vast history of behavior modification in science. When you kick around the things you're going to put on our plate next year in January, behavior modification tools. I will be looking for those very closely, taking the caps off of the amount that can be fined on the roadside, behavior modification, more troopers, whatever it is. If we're going to take big chunks off, like Representative Holmes was talking about, that's the biggest one, and it's a behavior. So let's modify the behavior. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think, too, as you're thinking through all this, it may not work in the Seward area. That might not be your best tool, but you might be able to use it in another area so you can free up a trooper to use down there. And so, I mean, there's different things that you can do in different areas, and so that's a possibility.
Point taken.
Representative Grimberg.
Punishment is most effective if it's swift and immediate. Have you given any thought to allowing, encouraging the fines, the tickets to be paid on the spot by a credit card? No.
I don't know
okay.
that I've ever been.
That's fine. We can talk later. I'm not suggesting. It obviously it's been thought about. Thank you.
Yeah. I was thinking they just have a credit card machine,
yeah.
Run it through, and that's it.
Yeah, I think I've got a lieutenant that might be a little embarrassed when he gets back to the office.
Okay, I won't get into this, but if the fine could be collected right on the spot, the amount of collection would, number one, go up, and number two, there'd be an immediate consequence.
Representative Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, if there were only a lawyer or two on the panel, I'm sure that they might object to the lack of due process in that.
No, I'm just suggesting that that would be an alternative if there were a no contest.
The if I may comment, sir.
Certainly.
To the chair. All of the, you know, there have been a huge number of recommendations regarding what we could do better, what will actually work, what doesn't work that we should stop doing. And all of those recommendations, including the recommendations that you're offering as well, will be taken into consideration and discussed and talked, not only internally with us, but also with the Department of Law, Department of Transportation, maybe formally with this body, maybe informally with members of this body as well. To determine what the best route and what the best solutions can be, I assure you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I heard a common thread between Representative Grunberg and Representative Johansson, and I will ask you to take into consideration when I was in junior high school, Mr. Kachuri, our vice principal, gave me SWATs and perhaps roadside corporal punishment. I'm just trying to stitch everybody together here because we wanted it to be a constructive meeting. Anyway, Commissioner, we thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roadside
Commissioner, thank you very much for your assistance putting together the program. Gentlemen, I will invite you to wrap things up in the next few minutes. We do have two members from the public that are still here who would like to offer testimony, and it's important that we take their testimony, and we have a committee hearing at 2 o'clock. So, gentlemen, if you want to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of the slides that we're going to show you've already seen, and these are just of the highway safety corridors, and I wasn't really going to talk about them other than to show you what kind of information that is being shared from DOT to AST. Without this information that's coming across from them in our collaboration, we're not going to be as effective as we need to be. So moving along, I know that delay of five vehicles is a very important topic that has come up not only in Girdwood, but it comes up quite often. The state statute specifically talks about the delay of five vehicles, and it comes under the statute talks about unlawful obstruction or blocking of traffic. This particular statute says if you have five vehicles or more on a two-lane roadway outside of the urban area that you have to pull off. But the statute specifically doesn't have a speed limitation attached to it. So going a little bit further, we do have an administrative code that actually addresses somewhat of the speed that is attached to it. And it talks specifically about a vehicle proceeding at less than the maximum authorized speed where you have five vehicles or more, you do have to pull off. But you have to have an area that you can actually pull off. Going down the Seward Highway, we've all seen the different places that you think that you might be able to pull off with a motorhome or a truck pulling a boat, being able to slow down some of these bigger vehicles to take a right-hand turn that most people think is a turnoff is actually causing kind of a bottleneck in itself. And then trying to get back on the road is actually causing a bottleneck again. So if you're a recreator that's trying to get down the Kenai Peninsula, it's going to take you a while to get down there. So having everybody education-wise, telling everybody we need to slow down, don't be in a rush. If you think you want to get there, leave earlier, prepare for what you're trying to do. So the five-vehicle delays, it's a good process, but we do need to make it a little bit easier for the motoring public to actually make use of those.
Thank you, Representative Holmes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, what's the penalty for violating this?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, the penalty is a $100 four-point ticket if you're outside the corridor, but if you're inside the corridor, it's a $200 ticket.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Continuing on the delay of vehicles, statewide, as it is right now, citations between 1997 and 2009 statewide on two-lane highways outside the urban area, there's only been 134 tickets issued in this particular offense. 35 of them specifically on the Seward Highway, and 12 of those are specifically in a safety corridor. Mm. There's not a lot of those tickets being written because it is a more difficult citation to actually write, because if you're driving in a patrol car heading south and you've got a line of cars coming north, how do you know that this person hasn't just come back on the highway and taken advantage of the pull-off? So having public interaction, if we're having people call us up saying, I am right now traveling behind someone doing 35 miles an hour. We've been doing it for 50 miles, and he's passed 10 different locations. We can actually take advantage of doing that as long as the public actually wants to participate and go to court when we do those citations. Because if we go purely off of someone saying they did it with no follow-up and we can't see it, we can't prosecute something like that. So these are harder citations to write. But we can identify these issues and educate the public a little bit better. And I think that it's a hot topic. I think the DOT, the engineers, are already trying to come up with different ways to make it easier for the recreators to actually pull off, get back on the highway, and make it safer for everybody.
Thank you.
Some of the Seward Highway safety corridors, the impaired driving, Labor Day, this is what we're doing currently. And I know that this is something that is not necessarily just in response to what has been happening right before the Girdwood meeting that occurred. We've been down on the Seward Highway since Memorial Weekend. But some of the things that we have already planned for the Labor Day enforcement, we have national campaigns, and we're currently in a national DUI or impaired driving crackdown, and that's funded ASTEP money, which in ASTEP is an Alaska Strategic Enforcement Partnership funding. It comes through DOT to all the municipalities and the state to pay for overtime for impaired driving enforcement. We're actively doing impaired driving enforcement on the Labor Day weekend itself, and that's throughout the entire state. We've started a program that we call Saturday Night Blues, and that's sustained DUI or impaired driving enforcement every Saturday of every week. We've identified that on the weekends you have more impaired drivers. That's where we're at. Chose particularly Saturday nights because we're having more collisions on a Sunday morning. So that's where we're going with that part. We currently have the Alaska State Fair. So that's right now, that's where the Bureau of Highway Patrol is, as we're taking care of the Alaska State Fair traffic enforcement duties. But while we're doing that, we still have enforcement going on in the Seward Highway. That's where the ASTEP, the partnership, comes in again with the DOT, with federal money. So we've got the e-detachment troopers, and we have our Bureau of Investigations. We're doing extra enforcement on those areas that we can't cover right now until we are able to grow a little bit more and take care of multiple areas at one time. We are doing traffic safety corridors with the ASTEP. And I think we've already gone over the short-term and the long-term with Commissioner Masters before he left. So if there's any other questions.
Very good. Members, any questions we do? Is Mark Ryan still in the room? Good, Mark. We'll get to you in just one moment, I promise. Representative Dugan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick request for some information. Could you send me a list of the organized boroughs in which the state troopers are doing law enforcement?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other final remarks for these gentlemen before we take testimony from Mr. Ryan? Representative Grunberg?
Just one question on the mandatory headlight law. Does the department, what is the department's position on that? And specifically, do you favor it mandatory all year round or just during the winter months?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, without the commissioner being here, I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I know that we have had a lot of discussions about it, and I would think that it is a very, very positive law that needs to go in. I personally agree with it, and I would push for it to go, although we do have a regulation that's out there that makes having headlights on in posted areas such as the Seward Highway. As long as you have it posted with the signs, it is mandatory to have it. You can actually see the vehicles a lot faster if they got the headlights on, and we actually have a media campaign going on right now for it. So I would lean towards, you know, we're going in that direction.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Gentlemen, excellent presentation. We appreciate your sensitivity, and we look forward to effective results coming from the Bureau of Highway Patrol, and we appreciate your collaboration with the other agency, with the Department of Transportation. So if we could have Mr. Ryan come forward. Gentlemen, thank you again. Mr. Ryan, thank you for your patience today. We appreciate it. We're happy to hear from you. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Mark Ryan. I live in Anchorage. I'm a retired policeman from Colorado. I'm here today on my own behalf. I have no connection with any governmental agency in Alaska, short of paying taxes. I'm here because I'm a regular user of the Seward Highway. A lot of my use involves pulling a fifth-wheel trailer down there. I wonder if I may address a question to the committee. How many of you own RVs and ever travel on the Seward Highway? Anybody? Two. Okay. Several years ago, a portion of that highway had the speed limit raised from 55 to 65. On my first trip on that highway, I said, well, okay, give it a try. And I drove 65 miles an hour on that portion. My fuel consumption raised 10%. Other portions of that highway, where it's 65, are simply not conducive to pulling a large fifth-wheel trailer because it is not the smoothest highway around. The delay of vehicles thing is a particular concern to me because in order to avoid abusing my unit and to somewhat mitigate fuel cost, most of the time on the entire highway from here to Seward, which I travel numerous times every summer, I will drive 55 and not faster. Therefore, I'm between a rock and a hard spot because I am more prone to being cited for delaying vehicles. I will routinely pull off when I can, even with fewer than five vehicles behind me. It's not always easy, it's not always possible, and as has already been commented, it's very difficult sometimes to get back onto the highway. The way the law is written at any time, to me, is frankly unworkable and unenforceable. I don't know how these troopers managed to do it at all, because if there are seven vehicles in a row, are the first two in violation or only the first one? What is the difference between a line of 12 vehicles and two lines of six vehicles? And how close does the first vehicle behind me have to be before I am delaying him? These are pragmatic and realistic questions which are not addressed by the statute. I think the intent of the statute is all well and good, and I support it. It has to be an enforcement nightmare. If you have 100 vehicles in a row, are 95 of them in violation? And I have been on that highway when there are 100 vehicles in a row. All right, you can't see. And some of them are crazy, because if you leave a good distance from the vehicle in front of you, somebody's in there, yellow line or no. No passing zones. That's good, except that I routinely see people drive over the double yellow line to pass me. The speeding thing, I really question sometimes the value of speed limits because I think people drive what they think they can get away with. And if you raise the speed limit on Minnesota to 60, then you're going to have people driving 70 because they think, or 67, because they can probably get away with anything less than 10 over. All right, so I agree with this comment here. I wanted to address that. Punishment, penology, has shown that severity of punishment is not a deterrent to crime. Execution is not a deterrent to murder. But the swiftness and the certainty of the punishment are proven deterrents. I think photo radar was a good idea. I'd like to see it at some of the intersections in town for red light violations. But do it for safety. Don't do it for revenue. And if it's in school zones, don't do it after school hours. I think photo radar would be a real good thing on the Seward Highway. There was one other point that I had, and now I've lost it in all of this. The other point I had is gone. Does anybody have a question for me?
Any questions, Mr. Ryan? Mr. Ryan, we thank you for some common sense and for, we think, echoing the sentiments of many of the travelers on the Seward Highway corridor in particular, because it's, we're sensitive to the fact that there's a recreational component, and practicality always always should have a seat at this table. We thank you for.
I wonder if it would be reasonable to have that speed limit reduced to 55 all the way during the summer months when RV traffic is the highest.
It's an interesting question. We will pose that to Mr. Martindale at DOT as they consider enhancements to that corridor in particular.
Maybe it's not practical because that means you have to change a whole lot of signs twice a year, but. I think something needs to be done. I, for one, I like to see the troopers out there on that highway. The more, the better.
Agreed. We agreed.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. And I think on that note, if there are any final comments, otherwise we will adjourn the meeting in 5 minutes. Madam Chair?
Thank you. I just took quite a few notes during this, and I'm really pleased that we heard a lot. We asked a lot of questions, but that was good because in asking questions, we learn a lot. So I appreciate everyone that came. I appreciate the comments and even the public comments. And so thank you very much, everyone, for taking time out to join us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With that, at 2:05, we're adjourned. Mm-hmm.